game right here on Monday Night
Show. You want a war? You're going to get one.
You fans can stick it, brother.
Brett screwed Brett.
This is bullshit.
And I also appreciate the fact that, hell, you can kiss my ass.
Hello everyone and welcome to the 68th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside Cole Jones.
Get off my lawn.
G. John Chase.
I hate change.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening.
And as you can tell from the new intro, we are back this week for the Monday Night War timeline. Starting 1998 this week, discussing January and February. So much to discuss. Obviously, we wrapped up 1997 at the end of last year. As always, we have notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters of the time to guide us with the timeline. So lots of fun little tidbits are going to be discussed throughout the course of these podcasts. Of course, you can listen to the previous episodes by going to squaredcirclegazette.com, where we archive absolutely every show we've ever done. And just a quick programming note for next week as well. We will be doing part two of Wrestling's Scummiest Moments. We started last week, did part one, got a very good reception for it. So we're going to hit part two next week, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But delving now into the Monday Night War timeline, because we do have so much to discuss, so many notes as always. 2 months, we mentioned when we did the last one as well, that we're not going to do these in quarters, we're going to do these in 2 month increments, and that is because 1998 is such a newsworthy year. 1997 was nuts, but 1998 is so newsworthy. There are so many notes and so many things to discuss. We want to give this its fair due and its fair time, so we're going to do this in 2 month increments. Of course, we delved straight away that the first Nitro and Raw of the year is on January 5th. Nitro in the Georgia Dome, a company attendance record straight away to start off the year, with 26,773 fans in the Georgia Dome, the second highest gate in company history, and a merchandise record set at $176,000. We kick it off with the NWO arriving in their separate limos, as the Ascension is teased here right from the off within the NWO. This is something that actually kind of teased very briefly back in April of 97. And something that I'll give WCW credit for, they actually remembered that, and the following week they played the clip of that Ascension from April. So a little bit of a long-term memory there. It's a shame they didn't have that for the rest of the year. Meltzer said this is actually an uneventful television show, except for a tremendous confrontation with Ric Flair and Bret Hart to build up their pay-per-view main event at Sold Out, which I want to talk about, because this is a great little deal here where Flair calls Bret out to the ring. Obviously, the previous week, Flair had taken exception to Bret referring to himself as the best there is, best there was, best there ever will be, and asks Bret to come to the ring and say that while Ric Flair's standing in the same ring. So Bret and Flair get into a pretty good back and forth, and this is really good stuff. I like this a lot. Although I query Bret's first match being with babyface Ric Flair. I think that kind of put him in a very strange position to start his WCW run.
It certainly does, and Meltzer's absolutely right. I watched this show back yesterday, in fact, and found it to be, considering the venue and the hard numbers you mentioned there, Lynn, which are incredibly impressive, it's such a nothing show. outside of the Flair and Bret altercation, I think there's really nothing to it at all. I'm probably not as high on it as say Meltzer is there, and I think that's partly because I don't think even at this point the crowd know how to take Bret.
No.
Because all the anti-America stuff is still so fresh in the memory. And a lot of the screwdriver, I think, is still over a lot of fans' heads, even at this point, in truth, in terms of the swerve from a promoter thing. It's not something that is really at the forefront of people's minds, I don't believe, anyway. That almost affects the angle a bit, because the crowd don't quite know how to take Bret.
No, but they are totally into Flair, however.
Oh, well, in Georgia, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, of course. You're saying, yeah, you're a big deal up in Canada, but this is Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm, what is it he says, premium USA manhood.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of felt awkward position for Bret as a face, but look at the alternative. Like, if he'd have come straight in feuding with like a Nash or a Hogan, he'd been getting his ass beaten down every week for 2 months straight.
Yeah,
and at least it's a step up from just appearing backstage and being a guest referee at Starrcade.
Well, yeah, as you said, Carl, the only way was up after the auspicious start.
By this point, like, they were kind of messing around with Flair a lot, booking wise or whatever. They were desperately doing their attempt to freaking ruin the guy. I don't think it was like, oh, let's give Bret a real good chance in his first match here, let's put him with Flair. It was much more like, Put them with Flair.
Stick them together.
Sting together. Put those two assholes together, and we'll just continue doing our fucking, you know, insider shoot shit.
You got your nice little history though. Brett taking the WF belt off him.
And he did mention that in that first promo. Where he said, you know, to be the man, you got to beat the man. I think I've done that once before. Also on this show, there's a couple of the noteworthy things. Diamond Dallas Page pins Chris Jericho. Jericho had obviously snapped the week before. Before the match, Jericho apologized for his actions and bought Dave Penzer, the ring announcer, a new suit. After losing, he freaked out. Rick Martel debuts on this show as well, beating Brad Armstrong. Rick Martel felt completely out of place here for me in this very brief return in WCW. The main event is Lex Luger versus Randy Savage. Luger wins with an inside cradle, and Savage freaks out about losing, and in his rage accidentally turns around and punches Eric Bischoff in the face and leaves him laying. Hogan runs down and starts yelling at Savage for what he'd done. Nash ran out and clotheslined Savage, and Hogan yelled at Nash. Hogan talked the entire NWO into hitting the ring to destroy Luger, but then Sting ran in to help Luger, and the show goes off the air. So again, the idea here is to primarily build the NWO split, potential NWO split, to build ratings for the debut of Thunder that's coming later this week. Over on Raw, very newsworthy show here. First of all, we'll get to the fact that Jeff Jarrett becomes the NWA North American champion when Jim Cornette helps him beat Barry Windham. Obviously, again, Cornette had done the promo the week before, talking about how he was going to be the guy to bring some wrestling in. Howard Brody and Dennis Coraluzzo come waddling down the aisle with this mysterious belt. Cornette tries hard to get this lineage over, but this falls flat.
Yeah, outside of Double J's sweet entrance music during this period, there is nothing to write home about for that segment.
Although, the primary thing on this show, and it starts with Steve Austin talking about how he's going to do unto others before they can do unto him, and this match starts the great lineage of Steve Austin coming out, stunning everybody, in the case of Jarrett, hitting the ropes and doing the worst strut you'll ever see.
Well, it's not like, if they did like something like this with Roman Reigns, it'd be a total, first of all, this is AEW 1 versus all, and it'd be a total diminishing returns, but like the pops get bigger every time Austin comes out.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it?
Great.
Yeah. It's like they get excited because he's coming from different parts of the crowd and he does his run-ins and people, like, the crowd's just going nuts for this. He also sends Mark Merrow and throws some fantastic jabs in the air. Merrow's doing his boxing gimmick. Gets out of the ring. Sable was gazing in his direction as he left Merrow laying. Austin does a little stare down with Sable here.
Yeah, he does a lot of blondes, so.
Yeah, well, yeah. Paul Bearer does an interview crying that Kane had left him. This is quite funny when they show that the picture they're coming up. Paul Bearer's got issues with Kane. They show a picture of Bear looking horrified, like completely disheveled. It's very funny stuff. Goldust in blackface versus Flash Funk here. Coming out dressed as Shaft. Not sure about this. The artist formerly known as Goldust, of course. A very shameless period of his career that we're going to talk about over the course of this show.
That's got to be for the mind of Vince McMahon, surely.
Oh, of course it was.
Into the minstrel show.
Nah, let's put it on Russo. Anything bad is going on Russo. Anything good is anyone else but Russo. have we mentioned Jarrett's horrible pants, horrible trunks before?
No.
They're horrible.
What, the white singlet?
Full body white. JR continually buries as being as a tribute to the Aztecs or something. It's like... It's horrible.
Yeah. Jarrett, they were trying so hard to get him over, but he wasn't clicking at all. This entire period, since his comeback, he hasn't clicked at all. The main angle on this show is a casket angle with Sean, where Sean's got the casket that they've spray-painted the previous week. He thinks that it's Hunter and China in there, and then Hunter and China come waving out, saying, no, no, no. And then Sean's just on the microphone saying, so, if you're over there, what's in here? And kind of ruins the whole thing, to be honest. But Taker's in there, obviously.
Was this the week of Don King?
Don King, yeah. The appearance of Don King doing a taped interview signifies there has to be some sort of an agreement between the two sides, Don King and the WWF, already reached. The basic belief is that Tyson is going to wind up as a referee for one of the main events at Mania. His appearance will garner tremendous media attention at the beginning, says Meltzer. Probably more negative than positive, but it will get the WWF name out. WWF is attempting to build this year's WrestleMania around using sullied, soiled, and sleazy celebrities, which is a tactic that will only make wrestling's image as a whole even worse than it was, but that's the direction that WWF has been going for months to begin with.
Well, he downplayed the impact of Tyson there, didn't he, Big Dave?
I don't think that he really realised what it was going to be. I mean, we mentioned when this was actually announced on the previous episode of Raw, it was kind of brushed off as a, well, that seemed like a cheap attempt to bring his name in for a pop. And this week it's like, okay, something's happening, but we don't really know what it's going to be.
Don King cuts his ace promo.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
So he doesn't, another couple going down the line, but this is his best one.
It's just, by far.
Him and Vince going to try and work it out. Tyson, WrestleMania, two biggest brands in the world getting together. He just plugs the date over and over again. It's a fantastic promo.
Moving on to the results of that night, Nitro did a 4.3 to Raw's 3.3, so both shows go a little bit down, but Nitro with a full point lead, so Nitro looking very strong here to start 1998. Interesting little tidbit I didn't know here, WCW was in serious negotiations with Oscar De La Hoya, the current biggest drawing card on pay-per-view, about doing a referee gig on a pay-per-view show. The idea proposed was for De La Hoya to referee a match with Eddie Guerrero versus Rey Mysterio to try and build more of a Latin base for the WCW crowd and give Guerrero and Mysterio Jr. the chance for the media rub, particularly since they'd likely have a spectacular match which could shock people that would normally be inclined to run the event down. However, De La Hoya's people were carefully controlling his image as the Golden Boy and felt participation in pro wrestling would sully that image, and at this point the deal looks unlikely. WCW was then interested in trying to get Tyson. However, sources close to the situation claim the price Tyson and King have negotiated with the WWF may be out of WCW's league. So a little bit too little too late there. You had your chance in Vegas.
De La Hoya would have been, that would have been excellent.
Yeah, it would have been great
deal, but you reckon if they signed De La Hoya, some of those big guys would have said
Conan would have clued everybody in.
it's a waste, yeah, and he'd been in an NWA shirt.
Exactly. Right now, most of the WCW junior heavyweights, due to the feeling of there being no respect for them and no upward mobility, are frustrated, and many, if they weren't under contract for a few more years, would rather be elsewhere. Shocking news that.
Yeah, they're upset now, but you know, time heals all wounds, and I'm sure things will improve.
On January 7th, sources close to Hulk Hogan claimed that he was to meet with Dr. Harvey Schiller on this day about a new deal, as negotiations for Hogan's contract have gone over Eric Bischoff's head. Rumours got so out of hand that it was actually reported in mainstream newspapers that the WWF hotline had claimed Hogan had signed a 2-year deal with them. After that came out, Jim Ross on the WWF hotline strongly denied any negotiations had ever taken place and went so far as to claim that the entire story was all manipulation by Hogan to create a story and try and get a raise.
They plugged it on Raw. When they plugged the hotline, they mentioned, you know, talk about the shocking story behind Hogan possibly returning, or I can't, you know, to paraphrase, but
yeah, it wasn't just Scheme Gene that was at it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they used any way to make money that you can possibly get with a name star.
Yeah, everyone had shit on their hands.
It was, but again, interesting, because we know that we've talked about this before, Hogan's contract coming up near the end of Starrcade, he got away with a lot near the end of last year in terms of having his way over things, and it's going to continue because at this point he is not under contract.
Though I will admit, sorry, just when you were about to read that story and you started with Doctor, I did think for a split second you were going to say George Zahori.
Called him for a re-up.
Gone for a prison visit.
January 8th, it is what we've all been waiting for, the launch of WCW Thunder. There is more jockeying for position on television, with WCW moving to 3 hours on Monday, debuting Thunder on Thursday, and above all, ratings have improved from already strong numbers every Monday, with football season having ended. After showing footage of the Hogan vs. Sting match from Starrcade in Baltimore on the Nitro the following night, they announced the title was held up, but didn't announce how the vacancy would be filled. So we talked about this before, the Nitro that ended with Sting and Hogan wrestling as they went off the air. They show the finish on this episode of Thunder to establish that these two matches were screwy, the belt's vacant, and they didn't announce what they were going to do with the vacant championship at this point. The Thunder debut actually drew a 4.0 rating, going head-to-head with NBC's strong Thursday night lineup, including Friends, Seinfeld, and ER. Literally, almost nobody knew until a few days ahead whether the debut show would be 2 or 3 hours. So, more of that fantastic lack of planning that we've seen previously.
Absolute lack of planning, but again, testament to the strength of wrestling as a whole at this point, that they can do a 4.0 going against, you know, NBC and its pomp with Friends.
Yeah, in their prime, like Friends, Seinfeld, ER at their height. 4.0, impressive stuff. The WWF started its training camp this week under Dory Funk and Pat Patterson. No jokes, Carl. He wasn't teaching the go-behind before he can get it in. At the camp were Mark Mero, Darren Drozdoff, Tiger Ali Singh, Randy Blackbeard, Ahmed Johnson, Mark Henry, Steve Blackman, Matt Bloom, Sean Stasiak, Sean Morley, Adam Copeland, Kurgan the Interrogator, and Taka Michinoku. Reports are that Morley and Copeland are going to be major stars and get a huge push once they debut on television. They're internally being called the two Blue Chippers. I wonder who the source for that was, by the way.
Didn't you say Tucker was down there as well?
Tucker was there training. Well, you know, he wasn't good enough yet, Carl.
Well, no, clearly not.
The big news here, effective January 26th, Nitro will become a 3-hour show every single week. The decision was made largely because WWF's Raw ratings were showing significant growth as soon as Nitro went off the air over the past several weeks. It used to be that no significant percentage of Nitro viewers would switch to Raw when Nitro would go off the air, but that's no longer the case. So Bischoff, and we mentioned this again in the previous episode, that Bischoff was thinking of ways of dealing with Raw going to the later time slot. And this is the solution, unfortunately. The 3-hour Nitros, damn you, Lex Luger. It did well the first time, so I guess they've come to the conclusion. More.
Yeah, and it's a sign of the jitters from EZE.
Tyson will become a regular character in the WWF, starting with the Royal Rumble through WrestleMania, at which point he'll slide back into the boxing world. Whatever the true money figure is for this angle, believed to be $4 million or more, on paper it will take a very creative storyline to make him worth that kind of money when it comes to buys and a role other than a participant in a match. If the $4 million figure is accurate, the WWF needs 648,000 buys out of WrestleMania to make out. So again, he's Meltzer's. It's quite funny seeing Meltzer's perspective of not really seeing how big this can be, and I guess no one really did at the time.
I think Vince was having some sort of meeting. I can't remember who it was with, so I'm going to paraphrase pretty much everything. Questioning him on the amount that they were spending on Tyson, that Tyson won't draw that much extra, and there was a whole bunch of like figures that they were throwing around at each other. And Vince turns around and says, I would rather spend the money.
Oh, this is Basil DeVito. I remember this name.
Basil, I said, okay. He said, I would rather spend the $4 million and draw an extra 200,000 than not. And it was just like, kind of listening to that, you were thinking like, oh, that doesn't make fucking any sense. And then when you think about it, you're just kind of like, oh, well, oh yeah, of course. I just always thought, like, at that point, like, when I kind of heard that quote, I was just kind of like, okay, no, that's a businessman in talking there.
Yeah, well, it ties into Meltzer's next note here, actually, where he says that it will, however, re-establish the WWF as the brand name for pro wrestling after a year where WCW got most of the mainstream headlines. I'm almost expecting a WrestleMania climax of Austin hitting the stunner on Michaels, who, according to office sources, is already bellyaching about that. While Tyson KOs Helmsley. The expected negative media articles have, of course, started. The WWF expected it and maybe based on its new image, wants it. An article in the Chicago Sun-Times this past week called Raw the sleaziest show on television, and the New York Daily News reviewed Raw, seeing Goldust as a transvestite, in a diaper, and appearing in blackface as the stereotypical pimp, as well as the Puerto Rican biker and black gangs, and called McMahon the high priest of low life, and called Sable the house slut. Showing just how above it they are, I suppose.
Has Brock Lesnar eaten that man yet?
And this is all before Brent Bozell sticks his oar in.
We move to January 12th on a Monday Nitro. The main theme, again, there in keeping with it, it's the NWO split. Goldberg gets a huge pop as he wrestles Jerry Flynn. Goldberg's reactions really seem to change greatly over the course of the year. But from 97 to 98, it just seems like people really get behind Goldberg a great deal.
Even in this sort of first couple of weeks of 98, there is a noticeable difference in reaction.
Yeah, huge surge. It's actually not too bad a match because it's done very kind of just, they're going for submissions and stuff like that until Goldberg just smashes him in the end. It's quite fun. Ric Flair lays out Jim Neidhart this week, obviously in an attempt to continue the angle with Brett. Again, Flair's kind of heelish in this angle. He kind of knocks him out with nooks, talks about how, Neidhart, I understand that, in life we've all at some point been put under the thumb of a woman, and your woman is Brett's sister. So,
and he even busting out the old figure four around the ring post.
Yeah, Brett's move, which I thought was quite a clever little touch. The Outsiders versus the Steiner Brothers is the main event, with Nash giving Rick a low blow and covering him. Randy Savage goes to the top rope to deliver the elbow onto Kevin Nash, but Nash sees it, moves, Savage hits Rick, who was then pinned by Nash, so the Outsiders win the tag title. So even when they can't get along, they still beat everybody else.
Quick as a cat, Kevin Nash moves out of the way.
Over on Raw, the show opens up with DX in a limousine with Michaels climbing up out the sunroof and pulling his pants down. Your thoughts on Michaels around this the start of January, Kieran?
Try not to orgasm.
Yeah, just start playing the porn music.
I'm just thinking what's coming, Sam. I mean, he's great. He's awesome. He's a dick. I've had this feeling since the back end of 97. I just get the feeling that although they're being ace heels because they're both dicks, and especially Sean, obviously completely still in the show, I think they were trying to be in some ways playing for cheers in the context of the new direction of the company. Maybe I'm wrong on it, but I just, these through these 2 months, they don't get heel reactions. The crowd is 50-50 at worst, and the only time people actually boo it is with Austin Association when they just lose their shit for Steve.
I know exactly what you mean. It's a lot of the mannerisms that sort of portraying yourself as sort of the cool rebels in a sense, which I think there's a really more noticeable example of it in a few roars with the balloons and the placards that comes on from the Austin Tyson altercation. Following on from that, I think that's to me the clearest example of what you're alluding to.
I think when I kind of noticed it was around about like December time, so just kind of like before this, and I think it was they were doing some stuff with Slaughter quite a bit, and Ken Shamrock, and it was just like coming across as Slaughter was of an authority figure, and so they were just mocking the authority, and it was, as you said, about the rebels, kind of watching it going like, these guys aren't trying to get booed. I don't know whether they saw the writing on the wall with Austin or whatever, and they were trying to counter it.
Yeah,
I don't know, but they were definitely playing for the cheers.
They, because everyone knew what the appeal of Austin was, but, you know, long before this point. And it's like, okay, we can't be Steve Austin because, you know, Sean's the pretty boy. So what can we do to be that edgy kind of thing? And, you know, this is the era of like the spawn of South Park, and I'm probably Beavis and Butthead,
yeah.
And they even made a Beavis and Butthead reference about Sean and Hunter at one point. So it's like they're trying to create a new kind of face dynamic for themselves here by tapping into the Austin love kind of thing in their own way. So
apart from maybe one or two examples, they're not playing chicken shit, really. They're not playing cowardly. They've basically
they're
mocking the baby faces, so they're not, you know, they're not selling anything. Yeah. So
well, the thing is too, there are, after Brett's gone, there are actually so few stars in this company left that they were gonna try and get over as stars, and that's just the way it is. Also on the show, Kurgan wrestles in a handicap match. The training camp, says Meltzer,
is he the handicap?
Yeah, I think he's actually handicapped. Yeah,
that training camp did him at least some good, because 2 weeks ago he was wrestling like Giant Barber when he was 60, and now he wrestles like Barber did when he was 55. So again,
oh, nuts.
We get Ken Shamrock and Mark Henry versus Rocky Maivia and D'Lo Brown, and Henry turns on Shamrock and joins the Nation here. Comes out wearing the Rocky Sucks t-shirt. And
Rock Someone has written on in a Sharpie.
It's great though, because Rock's promo is like, I'm going to rip that shirt off your fat ugly ass.
Yeah, and while Triple H and Shawn weren't being heels and getting 50-50 reactions at worst, Rock is just an exploding fucking volcano of heat. He's like, oh god, this man.
The Rocky Sucks chants are always
the match,
there.
He's not even in the match, he's at just ringside, and the whole, I think it's probably been a couple of weeks, and just the whole match, it's just Rocky Sucks throughout this match, and like, he's not even involved in it. It's just,
Farouk was acting like he didn't know about the plot that for Mark Henry to join in and act mad about it. We were talking about how great Rock is. The scene backstage when Rock's, you know, Farouk's asking what the hell's going on, and Rock's saying, hey, look, I've got it, it's cool. And then he just looks at the camera, just like gives a little eyebrow, and he's just fucking full of just charisma. He's just hilarious.
This for you, then, the big guy for
this
you.
This for you, the big guy's for you. This is going to go great. Jim Cornette also introduces the Rock and Roll Express on this show to join the NWA to the Rockers theme song, no less. The crowd was dead. Morton, who was 41, and Gibson, who was 40, looked positively ancient, and it was actually like watching a Saturday Night Live spoof of two old men trying to be the Rock and Roll Express.
At this point, I'm thinking, good luck picking up the ring rats.
Yeah. Gibson looks like the guy from Happy Gilmore who screams jackass all the time. I don't know his name, but you know the guy I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, DX does an interview announcing Kane is their newest member, but it's the Undertaker that comes out. As Taker is distracted by Triple H, Shawn Michaels super kicks him, and they double team upon Taker until Kane makes the save. They played up big time that Kane had turned babyface and joined the Undertaker. Of course, this is the scene where both men go on the one knee, and the crowd goes fucking ballistic. I want to get one little thing in, though, because there's a match here. Very just completely nothing match. Taka Michinoku and Scott Taylor against Los Barriquas, who get used quite a bit during this period of time. And Jerry Lawler on commentary, in response to Sonny doing the announcing, dressed as a schoolgirl. Lawler.
Oh, good God.
Lawler. Lawler says, I have no problem dating younger women except when I have to drop them off at school.
Well done, King. He just completely leaves 95 behind.
So you just eat for life now. It's okay to make the joke with that one line. The main deal here is the Royal Rumble drawing, which closes the show. There is no actual drawing. Everyone just attacks each other. Steve Austin's kind of on the outside until they kind of, I think it's Savio and Rocky and some other schlub comes and attacks him on the ramp.
Yeah, I didn't like that. It was a go-home angle. It was kind of, I don't know what.
A bit sloppy. And I didn't like the fact that Austin was getting beaten up.
Exactly. I guess the story they're trying to tell was he's pissed off everyone, so he'd like
they all want
to
get him.
Yeah, you know, so it's making the story about him, stack the odds a little bit after he's got his shine by beating them all down. But they didn't really tell that story, and it ended up being just a couple of guys like taking him out. Like they take him out to the back, and then he comes back out onto the ramp, but he's still getting his ass kicked
again. Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't think that was not very great.
Yeah, it's a bit of a cluster, and you just, you know, you look at it logically, and you're sort of booking 101. No one gets their hands anywhere near him until the event itself.
Yeah. Although I guess he's going to win, so there's really no point. I guess maybe get the heat here because he's going to smash it anyway.
They're all no marks anyway. Who cares?
If you're going to get the heat, have like 20 guys literally to beat him down. So it's like, okay, well, you know, one-on-one, this guy's going to he's kicked you all your asses, but you know, maybe it wasn't smartest moved, because the whole build to the Rumble was purely Austin.
It's Austin. It is one versus all. It's his story.
So you don't want to make it too obvious. You want to create some drama, some conflicts. He has got to go through everyone now. So have everyone beat him down, not just three guys. That's kind of
not Quang and two people.
Yeah. Nitro does a 4.5 this week to a Raw's 3.4. So both shows with a little bit of improvement there. But again, just look at those numbers. Considering where we were when we started this timeline, 2.2 and 2.5, that very first Raw and Nitro head to head. And here we've got 4.5 and 3.4. Just the general health of the business is just so impressive at this point compared to where it was at the start. Deborah McMichael has been dropped from WCW as they nixed the idea of her managing Ric Flair as a heel. Over the past few months, WCW has dropped Sherry, Nancy Sullivan, Jacqueline, and now Deborah, plus Kimberly's involvement is strictly to lead to Paige's ring entrance, and she's basically just a Nitro girl. So the only woman with a role left is Elizabeth. Interesting thing there, getting rid of all the women, because that's something I guess WF would kind of indirectly capitalise on with their one woman who they went all out with. A couple of acquisitions here for the WWF this week. Dan Severn and his grey shirt have officially signed with the WWF as expected. He will definitely be billed as the NWA World Heavyweight Champion when he comes in and be managed by Jim Cornette. Also, Jacques Rougeau and Carl-Pierre Houlette, dusted off of mothballs here, also signed with the WWF and will likely reform the Quebecers.
I can see some big things with these guys.
Yeah, talk about
stomach.
Yeah, talk about people being out of place. Also, I think at this point we've got Jannetty in WCW as well, so there's just some peculiar roster signings during
this. Yeah, there are. WCW went on that kind of weird acquisition mode when they got like John Nord and Barry Horowitz and all these, like Jannetty, Chris Adams, those kind of guys.
Oh, yeah, the god awful John Nord Barbarian match where Barbarian gives up.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. Which, like myself, when I was watching it.
I think this, Dan the Beast, I think that's a great sign. I can't wait to see. You should put him with Ken Shamrock.
The only sleazy celebrity we know that is accepted for WrestleMania thus far is Pete Rose, who will probably be a timekeeper for one of the main events. Pete Rose will be getting $25,000 for his appearance. Almost any celebrity with a CD rep short of OJ Simpson will likely have been contacted. Charlie Hustle, Pete Rose is in for WrestleMania, which leads to a great moment that I can't wait to get to.
Yeah, that's a fun trilogy.
Yeah, it is. Good stuff. This year, though, is definitely the peak for me.
Yeah.
We move to, of course, the show we've just been talking about, January 18th. It is the WWF Royal Rumble. 18,542 fans sell out the building, the largest crowd ever to witness pro wrestling in Northern California up to this point, at a 0.97 buy rate for 275,000 buys, a better buy rate than any WWF pay-per-view of the previous year. A pretty good show. Steve Austin, of course, wins the Royal Rumble.
A really, really fun show. The numbers there just go to show that everything, they are gaining that traction now. Austin is clearly over. Michaels and DX have got their niche. Obviously, it's Tyson's first appearance, which can only help the buy rate as well.
Tyson gets booed in the luxury box, refers to Steve Austin as cold stoned.
Cone stone is the best.
Found the Rumble itself entertaining, even if it seemed kind of like predictable, obviously, with Austin going over.
It felt like almost no one was over in that match apart from Steve Austin, quite honestly.
Kind of
with one exception,
yeah,
I should say.
There we go. As well, I slightly disagree. Where obviously, Austin's over as Rover right now on the build up, but I think like this was a really good showcase for The Rock. For me, watching the Rumble, where the rest of it, the only real events that were happening in the Rumble that was interesting was Austin winning. Rock last until the end and really kind of showcasing the Intercontinental Champion. I think that's probably the last time you're going to hear me say that about a Rumble. And just for comedy purposes, the fact that Foley comes out three times, as three gimmicks all the way through, which is just like once the second person comes out, you kind of realise, okay, this is what's going on. But for one Rumble, I thought it was pretty entertaining.
Yeah,
it certainly needed something because the roster
stinks.
The roster stinks at the moment, and we're going to be quickly seeing some of those names you mentioned earlier that they've signed up and put in developmental. For what it was, I thought it was a decent Rumble main event. Was fantastic. Is this a show that they have the six man
midget match? And Sonny can't do a leapfrog over the midget.
I just find it hard to believe that Sonny struggled to get a leg over.
Of all the people. Meltzer adds, Rocky Maivia showed once again at this show he's a genuine top star, and given his level of experience and age, he has the potential to be everything that was predicted of him when he started. Of the entire roster, he's the one most likely to turn the big three into the big four. Of course, the main event on this show is Shawn Michaels Undertaker casket match. A couple of big things of note here. Kane turns heel, what a shock, and sets fire to the Undertaker's casket, so they end the show with the assumption that Taker has again died at the Royal Rumble. But of course, in terms of long-term vision, I mean, great setup for WrestleMania, but long-term vision, Shawn on his back. Michaels took one incredible bump early on, taking a backdrop over the top rope, cracking his lower back on the casket as he went over. He was really lucky he wasn't hurt on that one, says Meltzer.
Cursed him. Cursed the great man.
Crushed the disc in his back.
Go on, Kieran. I want to save the tears
the,
here.
The floor is yours, Kieran.
Yeah.
I've known you all my life.
At least that's how it seems.
I've said it before, I don't think the injury was one-fourth as bad as anyone's. He shouldn't have been out for more than a year at most.
It did look bad, though, to be honest.
Oh, it looks
so
awful.
When you showed replay, it looks like, oh, that's just that's literally the very worst way he could have landed that.
But he's Superman. He doesn't get hurt. He takes a licking and keeps on ticking, goddammit. The most resilient man in the WWE. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I haven't seen that match in a while. Like, what was his immediate reaction? Knowing kind of like Sean's temperament at times. Did he?
No, it's nothing. Did he
barely register it?
If you did not know that this was it, you could watch that match easily and just think, I don't look very nice. Moving on to the next spot, because he's doing that awesome pile driver on the stairs. He's
Look at Mania in the first half of the match. We'll talk about this in more detail. He's fucking going all out. And it's only when he's slowing down Steve, when he's on offense, he plays on his back injury.
Very interesting show. It's not a great show when you look at it match by match, but in terms of just the aura and the vibe of the show, you can feel that the whole company's on the rise watching this show.
Well, I'm glad you use that word, because it's something that I've felt watching it back. And how much watching Raw, that there is a vibe to the show. There's an energy to it all. And I really looked forward to, as I was going back to watch some of these to refresh my memory, really looked forward to going back and just sort of, okay, let's get to next week. Nitro, to me, was a completely different feel. And it's not that there aren't folks that are over. You know, obviously we've talked about Goldberg's getting over. Booker T is gaining traction as the television champion.
Jericho started his
Jericho, likes of Benoit, and obviously, you know, you then go on to your Sting or something. The company itself is hot, but I just felt watching it, it's just this sort of this sense of almost, you know, just standing still. Because it's Sting coming down from the rafters. It's dissension in the NWO, which we've seen before, and the fact that the NWO are still the main entity coming out of Starrcade.
Whether anyone kind of really realised it or not, when watching the Rumble, stylistically wise, it was kind of a bit of a spoiler as to what WrestleMania 14 was going to look like. I think they even have like a pretty like similar staging. Very minimalistic kind of look. Also very quite dark, low lighting and
grungy.
So on. Very grungy. I still swear to this day, I love that kind of look, hence why one of the reasons why 14 is my favourite Mania.
Moving to the next night, January 19th on Nitro, 20,644 fans in the Superdome in New Orleans. To counter the Mike Tyson hype, of course it was announced that Tyson was going to be on Raw, WCW at first led viewers to believe on Thursday that Hulk Hogan would be handed the WCW title back due to a court order on this episode of Nitro, a storyline that was never referred to on this show. And instead, to counter the Tyson appearance, they hyped a Hogan versus Giant singles match, which Hogan put the Giant over him with a chokeslam after Savage distracted him. Hogan also did a promo saying he was the boss of the NWO to play on the Dissension, but aren't going to shoot the big angle yet, although everything is done on the fly, and anything can change upon the shifts in the ratings. So that's pretty much the main thing here, is again continuing that Dissension between Savage and Hogan. That's the main story of the show, pretty much. Steiner's beat Conan and Bagel when Scott works the entire match by himself and wins with a screwdriver. After the match, DiBiase yells at Scott Steiner for never tagging out, and Scott walks away from DiBiase and his brother. Another great segment here with Flair and Bret Hart, and a really odd result, Rick Martel beats Eddie Guerrero, which is just horrific as far as I'm concerned. Nothing against Rick Martel by any means, but at this point, if I got those two guys on a piece of paper, I know who I'm picking.
Oh shit.
Over on Raw, meanwhile, a lot to talk about on this show, obviously. Sable gets given flowers from an unknown source, which is something that we'll come back to here. Barry Windham turns heel and joins the NWA, which is a really fucking weird deal, considering that this is one of those like Russo turns. This is like the blueprint for the Russo turn. 2 weeks ago, Windham got cost the NWA North American title when Cornette hit him with a racket, and now he's turning on Black Jack Bradshaw and joining up. Why? Who knows? We never find out. Of course, here we also get the segment where Shawn Michaels comes down from the ceiling as the Undertaker, but it's actually Shawn Michaels, and they do the DX barbecue. Complete with Suck the Cook apron.
Yeah. Thanks, Triple H, for coming again. but the fucking angle when Sean comes down, the crowd loses their shit, first of all, because it's like in silhouette and you look at Taker's gear. And then when he lands and he raises his hands, and then the lights come on and his music hits and he rips off the gear and starts dancing. It's like, fucking ace, I love this man.
is there.
Back looks good.
back looks fucking fine.
Maybe it was the maybe it's the support from the harness. It did it some good, you know? You know, maybe?
Going back, I think it was the week before, he comes out wearing his leather jacket and leather gloves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this fucking amazing look. It makes me want to buy a leather jacket and walk around the street with no shirt on.
Just on the subject, because of the way you sort of sarcastically mentioned, you know, thanks for coming, Triple H. Has there been a clearer example in wrestling history of where one person is just lucky to be near the other man?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Triple H offers or adds absolutely nothing to this.
He's trying to do the same...
He's trying to do the same thing that
exactly
Sean's
doing.
The same
thing as Sean, but he's so phony. And he's...
It just doesn't work, does
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no way.
He hasn't gone the full hog with like the change in look yet. He still just looks like a posh dick trying to be cool.
Straightened hair.
So yeah, so while Sean's, you know, you mentioned the leather jacket and leather gloves there.
Of course, the big angle on this show, there's no point in skipping past it anymore. Tyson and Austin. You heard it in the intro. What is there to say? One of the best angles.
The best.
It's amazing.
The best. It's the whole show long. Because like you see
Tyson being introduced to the wrestlers.
Tyson,
and stuff.
Everyone's mean Tyson. Glad handing him, shaking his hand. Even like DX and stuff. And the one you don't see is Steve Austin. And then fuck, when his music hits and he comes out, like the shit is on. Like, you're in his world now, son, and he doesn't like this. Oh, it's just it's beautiful, beautiful,
absolutely fantastic. And the optics, I've mentioned, remarked about this.
Oh, yeah.
The optics are something that Bill Watts would have loved to have booked with Tyson, his cronies on one side, and Austin, the WWF officials, the other side. Yeah. It looks like some sort of race war is about to break out, for crying out loud. But it's a fantastic angle that, you know, Liam, you said it's one of the best. Kieran, you've said it's the best. I think you can argue either one. It's just, it's so good, and the melee just seems so authentic. You get an angry Vince that you don't normally see. I think the only other time you'd come close to seeing it on TV was where Austin had knocked him off the ring apron back in December. So it's that continuation of the McMahon character transforming as well.
Throwing the little kick. Yeah.
Throwing the little kicks and the little the sort of swipe of the hand and screaming out how you've ruined everything. So you've got his sort of metamorphosis, if you like. It's just brilliantly done. And I think we'll see it more with the use of Tyson as well, but there's that tightness to the programme to me. The skits of Tyson with other wrestlers, the build throughout the show, contrasted with obviously Nitro and things on the fly and not really knowing what's happening. I think the use of Tyson, and as we've talked about it before, if we hypothesised with if he'd actually appeared on Nitro, I just think the use of Tyson here is a real clear sort of crystallisation of tight booking sense of direction. It's just really evident to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's in another way, another layer to it. It's like so we've teased for weeks that they've been negotiating, but they haven't kind of sorted it out yet. There's obviously issue with Nevada. What can he do? And then so Austin comes out and just pisses all over the party when Vince thinks he's finally got the deal done. And so that's a layer to that storyline. And now we've said it before about the opportunity Austin has been getting, the focus on him, how he's been running with the ball. This is the biggest moment in his career, and my God, he's on fire.
He goes all out.
He's in there with the man of the hour press wise in terms of all this, the boxing rigmarole. You know, and you mentioned before about him being booed at the Rumble. Tyson, this is Liam. Crowd reaction when they're in that ring. Those fans are solidly behind Austin.
Oh, yeah. Although I do a couple of funny moments here where Tyson yells at his favourite wrestler was Bruno Sammartino, with Vince standing in the ring, yeah, trying to shoehorn a Nikolai Volkoff reference in there as well for some reason. And Tyson afterwards, in a often forgotten moment, calling Steve Austin a faggot on the air to close the show.
Faggot. You know, the money incident as well, the money flies everywhere and everyone's picking up the money rather than actually trying to... In terms of Tyson's guys, are more worried about the money than Steve Austin. But for me, Austin's great. Austin's just continuing the momentum. Tyson plays his role well. It's Vince that really helps kind of sell this. Like Vince's reactions and the little things he's doing, as you said, the further development of his character. As soon as Austin's music hits, like, everybody's standing. That's it. Everybody's standing. Everyone's waiting because... And it's because it's been built up. It's been built up for so long, saying, like, Austin shits on everybody's parade and they've got the float out, you know, and he's fucking ready. You know, he's going to do something. I think the reason why the image was so great, because at that particular point, the outlaw, the guy who you can't control from boxing on one side, and the guy who they know because they've seen it every week, Vince can't control, and you're just watching these guys and they're inches apart. and everyone's on their feet because they know shit's going down. This isn't going to be like what we get now in wrestling, where two people stare each other down and they just have a friendly chat instead. And instead, like, the only time these guys will actually fight each other is if they do a fucking contract signing. It's like, no, these two are inches apart. And you know Austin's going to go Tyson. You don't slap your balls in a lion's mouth, okay? Because like, it's fucking Tyson. Austin looks badass, and so, but it's fucking Tyson. And it's just great. It's the two outlaws of two competitive kind of sports, whether one's fake or not.
Oh, shit. What's he going to do?
It's just
beautiful.
This gets tremendous mainstream coverage, covered in most newspapers and treated as a top sports story that evening and the next morning on radio and on shows like ESPN Sports Center and Fox Sports, including the BBC over here as well. The next day they ran it before Raw even aired. Nearly all the coverage was derogatory, but that was to be expected going in. The AP story, which ran almost everywhere, actually implied that the angle was a shoot, as did the USA Today. The WWF then released word, carried by the AP worldwide, that Tyson had challenged Austin and that the WWF would be meeting with the Nevada State Athletic Commission to see if it would be okay to make Tyson a participant. However, at press time, there was still much speculation as to what will actually happen at WrestleMania. Raw did its biggest rating since the Monday Night Wars began on this episode, doing a 4.0 rating, peaking with a 4.7 for the final 15 minutes. But still, it wasn't enough to beat Nitro, which did a 4.4. But man, a 4.0 to a 4.4, a combined 8.4 for this incredible night.
Wrestling's cool again, brain.
Hulk Hogan has not signed his new WCW contract, which we've been led to believe will be for 3 years, nor do I expect he will sign anytime soon, as being a free agent at this point gives him some major leverage. WWF sources vehemently deny there have been even preliminary talks with Hogan, and WCW sources insist he's not going anywhere. But again, you want to talk about Hogan being smart with when to sign his contracts and when not to. WCW's letting him, again, I mean, he is the main thing on the show. Currently, him and Savage is the top angle, and he's not even contracted. I mean, he has made everything about him, and they're letting him do it, which is the thing.
It's fish poor management. Why do you have him on TV?
Yeah,
with the remotest of chances, he might. Vince has thrown $4 million plus at Tyson. Who's not to say he's got an investor or something and he's got a big spare cash or whatever? Ludicrous on so many levels.
The Giants contract expires in March and the WWF is very interested in him. His name did come up behind the scenes at the WWF over the weekend, more as something hoped for as opposed to something expected. But again, this is around the period of time when Vince is looking at the Giants and thinking, you don't know how to book that guy.
Looking into the mindset of Vince McMahon, he's pushing forward with something new and edgy, right? And he's got like a new edgy star. He's got Shawn Michaels pushing the boundaries way beyond probably what they should be doing. And then here he is, kind of looking back at someone like the Giant. And we all know like the reason why he's looking back is he sees Andre. That's the whole point. That's why he likes the Giant. He's thinking, oh, they don't know how to book him because I could book him like Andre. And just from like a mindset of Vince McMahon, that's almost kind of slightly worrying, where no matter how forward-thinking everyone around him might be in terms of pushing the product forward, Vince is always looking back at what worked for him. And it's not like I'm against the Giant or anything, because I thought at that time he was of use. But it's just that thing of he's always looking back. It's just like, no, the Vince, it's because you weren't looking forwards all the time that you were fucking up for a while in the first place. You got something good, concentrate on that.
Well, everyone's got their comfort zones, haven't they? And we know what it is for Vince, and we've seen it in, as we've covered, you know, earlier phases of the quote-unquote war. And obviously something that, thankfully, as we go on, we'll see that is avoided for the most part. It's funny, Gene, in terms of talking about comfort zones as well and tying it back to Hogan being one of Vince's comfort zones from back in the day. Just thinking about this whole contract situation, and we can talk about the mismanagement of WCW and the poor planning till we're blue in the face, and I'm sure in many respects we will as the podcasts go on and we look through these timelines. But you just think, going there with a number in mind of what you're willing to give Hogan and what concessions you're willing to make, and then call his bluff. Because as we've pointed out already, Vince has already given a reported $4 million figure to Tyson. We know that they don't have buckets full of money to be thrown. They've only got a limited amount of resources off the base of what their financial losses were through sort of 95, 96 and what have you.
Brett was there to tell them.
Yeah, absolutely. We know the direction that the WWF are going in now. I don't think they'd look to take Hogan. We talk about these wrestlers who appear out of place, Martel being a prime example. Hogan would be a complete fish out of water in that era of the WWF. So you just think, you know, grow a set of balls, have a spine and just chance your arm, because you just, because it's so sad the way everything pans out. You just think, if you do this with Hogan now, maybe some problems that arise in later years just possibly could have been avoided.
The only thing I'd say to that is that that's kind of maybe underestimating how valuable they thought he was to their rise and their sustained rise.
Yeah.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, but you sort of, it almost becomes a vicious cycle for them, doesn't it? Because they allow him to manipulate them to that point. Scumbag.
Expect Louis Spicoli to join the NWO, probably in a Vincent-like flunky role. So that's in store for Louis Spicoli. Kurt Hennig and Rick Root have disappeared. Hennig suffered a knee injury a few weeks back that may require surgery. Originally, Hennig was supposed to interfere in the Flair-Hart pay-per-view match to set up a three-way feud, but I'm guessing that will change.
I'll bet Lloyd's Bank is shitting themselves.
Here's an interesting one. January 24th, negotiations between the WWF and All Japan Pro Wrestling took place in Tokyo on working together for a May 1st Tokyo Dome show. The 90-minute meeting ended with nothing even close to being decided. Barber told the Japanese press the next day that the two sides couldn't come to a financial agreement. The WWF was apparently very interested in using Kenta Kobashi in the US as a top-level star, but that deal would be very difficult to put together because he's needed full-time in Japan.
I just can't even imagine.
That would be absolutely impossible to fathom. Kenta Kobashi in his orange tights working with Steve Austin.
He's such a lass. working with Austin as Taka's big brother or something.
Yeah.
They'd put him in a fucking nappy and add him as a sumo or something.
Yeah.
Yoko's younger brother.
January 24th, WCW sold out a Rest Saturday pay-per-view because they didn't want to go head-to-head with the Super Bowl. 5,486 fans sold out the building. You may notice a very small audience number there compared to the Nitros we've just talked about. But a 1.0 buy rate for 290,000 buys, better than the Royal Rumble. And yeah, so obviously Bret Hart and Ric Flair is the main match on the show. Doesn't go on last, but it is the main attraction. Bret Hart goes over clean with a sharpshooter. A good start for Bret.
So what was the main event then?
The main event ended up being Luger and Savage. That went on last because Hogan was involved.
We know what the focal point is. It's been the same focal point since 96. It's been the same focal point throughout the whole of 97. And, you know, like I say, it's just this sense of they're almost, you know, the WF are starting to build up to their sprint, even if WCW's numbers are still ahead, because, you know, when you're hot, you've sort of built up a bit of credit, if you like. But WCW, to me, are running in treacle. And again, just as a point out to the lack of proper planning from this company, they run sold out the Harrah Arena in Dayton, the same site as ECW did a couple of Heat Wave shows. A crowd of what, just below 6,000?
Yeah.
When I know that we mentioned about they did that great show on Nitro in terms of revenue for the Georgia Dome and the Louisiana Superdome. You just think, for God's sake, yes, you'd have had to have booked these venues, you know, 3-6 months in advance, things like that. Back in 97, you knew how bloody hot you were. Why the hell did you pick this place?
Also, just in comparison, like in terms of the numbers, if you can remember, how was this in comparison to the sold out of last year?
Oh, significantly better, more than double the buy rate, because obviously the NWO sold out, absolutely tanked ass. Also on the show, some other notes, although we will mention obviously there, Luger and Savage had no heat at all, which caused some problems in the main event. Savage was very vocal after the show, claiming Flair and Hart had gone on too long, even though the pay-per-view actually went off the air 5 minutes early. It was a pretty good lucha opener to the show, and Dusty Rhodes joins the NWO by turning heel on Larry Zbysko. It gives Eric Bischoff his NWO colour commentator when they resurrect the idea of the NWO TV show, as there are thoughts being given to eventually make the Thunder show an NWO show once again. Of course, the idea was Rick Rude originally to be the announcer, but that was clearly not the answer, based on his commentary work.
Yeah. You talk about things that they can't get away from in terms of Vince and his comfort zone. Again, we go back to this Bischoff one of NWO. It's not a storyline. It's not a faction. It's its own brand.
Give it up, Aaron.
And he just can't get away from
it. It's bombed every time. Yeah, so also on the show, the Giant gets powerbombed on his head by Kevin Nash in a frankly frightening move, although it does lead to some kind of humorous stuff on television for the next couple of weeks. Chris Jericho wins the Cruiserweight title from Rey Mysterio, so this is the cementing of Jericho as now the guy in the Cruiserweight division. And
yeah, he was one of the real few reasons I had to watch Nitro at this period. As Carl said, I just wasn't inspired by a lot of the product. Obviously, I had the WWF bias as well. Jericho was the standout. You know, you like seeing guys progress, and you know, that's the exciting thing with Austin. We saw his birth and his growth. And Jericho, yeah, we've seen this character emerge, and
hoping, yeah, maybe he could be a top guy one day.
There's more successful time periods for Jericho in his career, obviously winning world titles and so on, but for me probably the most entertaining was definitely this early period in WCW, where I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it was because he was so far down the card that no one was really concentrating on him, so he could kind of do what he wants, and because of that he had such freedom, probably even more so than he would have when he eventually goes to WWF where everything's micromanaged. Probably. Like, he's really fun here. It's such a stark contrast to what he's fucking like now, but it's just this is like
Rooty Tooty Booty.
Don't get me started. I'll get on that when we do a Rumble podcast. But yeah, here he's fucking awesome. The Monday Night Jericho and stuff. I got that t-shirt.
This is actually a very enjoyable show. Raven and Benoit have a really good match on this one too. Funny note from Meltzer here. He says, Raven is so much better than I thought he was last year. Either that or Benoit is so much better than the Sandman.
Well, let's think of that one.
Yeah. Things that make you go,
A bit of one and a lot of the other, I think.
I just love to imagine Meltzer laughing at his own jokes.
That's a zinger. Enter.
Yeah. The next night, it is the first of the permanent 3-hour Nitros here on January 26th. A bad show, surmises Dave Meltzer. J.J. Dillon bans the powerbomb, obviously, after Kevin Nash almost cripples the Giant at Sold Out.
Should have banned the buffet for Big Show.
All the wrestlers were told no more power bombs, and they had a translator in Espanol telling all the Mexicans that if any of them did a power bomb, they'd be fired on the spot. Steve McMichael did an interview, leading to Davey Boy Smith coming out and issuing a challenge for later in the show. Whose idea of a practical joke was that? Yeah, this leading a tremendous series of matches between Bulldog and Mongo as Carl's head falls into his hands. Bret Hart did an interview where he actually praised Ric Flair and then challenged Hogan or Sting, depending on who wins the WCW title match, which is coming up at Super Brawl. Kevin Nash was disqualified for using the powerbomb on Ray Traylor in 30 seconds, and Doug Dillinger handcuffs him, and they do a comedy routine based around that. Savage does a promo telling the NWO not to interfere with him from this point forward. Lex Luger then beats Scott Hall in the main event by DQ, and Savage attacks Lex Luger. Sting makes the save and puts Savage in the Scorpion, while Hogan and Hall just watch and laugh at Savage not interfering with him just as he asked. The fans were trashing the ring by this point, by the way, so Hogan and Savage taking up the primary real estate on TV. Over on Raw, Kane tombstones Vader to set up their match at No Way Out. Instead of the promised Owen versus Triple H, it was Owen Hart versus Goldust dressed up as Triple H with a blonde wig and large fake nose, with Luna dressed up as China. The match ended when Owen wins using the sharpshooter, but DX got on the video wall and made fun of him for wasting his time. Slaughter then told DX the joke was on them, and since Triple H was supposed to be in the match and he wasn't, Owen Hart is the new European champion, which might be one of the most creative ways of switching the title without doing the job I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I'm putting this one on Russo.
Yeah?
Fuck
so?
You, Vinnie Roo.
I don't know if I want to blame Triple H for this, but this stinks.
Yeah, really. It's definitely Vinny that's pulled the trigger on this one, but it sounds like someone else loaded the gun in terms of this fucking idea.
Well, it's a Michael special, isn't it?
Yeah. I got an idea how I can lose the belt.
How we can get out of it, yeah.
I would normally piss a man about the way it would hurt a title not having a proper handover, but it's a European title, and they'd already pissed about with it in the Triple H Shawn match.
I guess so. But again, what a lineage this belt has. The show ended with a Steve Austin interview regarding Mike Tyson, challenging him to show up in Houston for No Way Out of Texas, which is coming up on pay-per-view. Coming off a week of worldwide publicity, the likes of which the WWF hasn't received in more than a decade, after what will go down as an all-time classic angle with Austin and Tyson the week before, the rating fell to a 3.5 this week. Dropped off half a point there. A very good number on the surface, but it actually got even less viewers than it did the week before the Tyson angle even took place. This shows that all the publicity and the angle itself actually meant little or nothing when it comes to increasing mainstream curiosity in the product for more than a few days. Nitro, increased to its now permanent 3-hour length, drew a record for an opposed time slot, despite having its worst show of the year, with a 4.7. So, very interesting fallout there from the following week.
Those two ratings, those two shows, in those two companies, in their two dynamics, there's a massive, massive moral to that tale, in terms of looking at one week ratings and drawing big conclusions, and not seeing the effect of the big picture. And I think everyone who's running a fucking wrestling company in the world today needs to look at that and think about it for a second or two, because I don't think they have before.
1 week rating doesn't mean the world. There's a bigger picture at hand, folks, sometimes.
Absolutely, and to me, I dare say we're all in agreement here, these WCW numbers are more just a sort of a residual effect, if you like, coming off how hot they've been for the previous 18 months, as opposed to what they're
but the numbers are actually growing, like I said, all-time record here, you know, it's
creeping towards the five.
That was the all-time record for Nitro, 4.7 in a head-to-head situation, so I mean, it's growing, if anything.
And maybe the numbers will prove me wrong as we go through the rest of these shows for this period, but you do have that sort of that lust, if you like, of it's the first, you know, the first permanent three-hour Nitro, so that gives it a sort of a credence, if you like, that it might not necessarily have had if it was just, you know, the standard two-hour show. So I know what you mean. You know, it's hard to argue with the number on the surface, but I just think when you're hot, there is so much you can get away with up to a point. And whilst the numbers aren't reflected for the WWF yet, the chaos versus the more solid nature of what the WWF are putting together, I just think it's almost like that Vince thing where you sit there and think, How are they still winning?
How are they getting better with this?
And it's not the quality, you know. It's not the, you know, the quality of the content. So I just said, I think it just has to be. They're still got credit in the bank from what they've done previously.
Well, they still. I mean, again, in all fairness, the WWF didn't, like we said, they didn't have a lot of stars, and there was a lot of dross underneath. There's the Godwins, there's the DOA and the Truth Commission.
Oh,
and the
there's far too much DOA on these Raws for my liking. Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
Well, that's the point. This is. Even if that 1 week rating doesn't reflect it, this is WWE is growing as in terms of talent, in terms of their own identity. They're developing. WCW has a massive roster with massive stars, with massive momentum.
An awesome talent.
Yeah.
Vader appeared to have been injured on that episode of Raw when Kane tombstoned him, as Kane lost control of Vader and appeared to drop his head too low on the tombstone. Apparently a plate he has near one of his eyes due to the injury in the famous Tokyo Dome match with Stan Hansen, where his eye popped out, got dislodged. So that's why Vader needs the eye surgery after No Way Out.
That is understandable, because, you know, Vader is a big fat piece of shit.
he was pretty over at this little point there.
Yeah,
like,
Vader still had some
big badass. He was standing
at the Rumble, Kane. Man, he was over huge against Goldust.
I mean, not Vader. I just fucking hate that that moment.
Rey Mysterio Jr. had reconstructive surgery on his knee on January 28th at the age of 23 years old.
Won't be his last.
No. My feeling, says Dave Meltzer, is that the plan McMahon and Don King have come up with is that they will tease a match, then Tyson backs out and only referees, thereby showing the power of the Nevada State Athletic Commission. Tyson himself is portrayed throughout as a babyface, gets a big pop at Mania, his image gets softened, and the commission gets his authority kissed up to, and in the end they will reinstate him in July and he's back in boxing where he collects his real paydays. But a funny thing has happened. Mark Ratner, the executive director for the Nevada State Athletic Commission, made it very public that he considers wrestling as stage entertainment and doesn't care what Tyson does within the WWF's play-acting world. So there's a bit of a knock-on effect from this later on when it comes to the use of Mike Tyson. The Nitro girls were on Regis and Kathy Lee this past week to show how much Regis follows WCW. When Kimberly was talking, they acknowledged her husband in the audience, and Regis referred to him as Diamond Dan.
Oh, that is a gimmick. Diamond Dan. He just needs to have like McGrew as his last name.
If Danny Dyer was, it'd be Diamond Danny Dyer, wouldn't he?
On an internet chat, Conan was praising the direction of the WWF and said that WCW isn't interested in pushing the Mexicans, and said that when their contracts run out, he expects they'll all try and go to the WWF.
Someone's looking for a job.
There's a team player for you. Thanks, Conan.
How could they get ahead of Pantera in the Hispanic rankings?
Yeah, and Orgula, who does have a nice twisting plancha, but...
Don't forget Papi Chulo.
The working plan is still for a Mero versus Butterbean rematch at WrestleMania at this point. Just a little tidbit there. Butterbean wouldn't appear again until the following WrestleMania for one of your favourite moments, Carl.
Oh, wonderful.
Jim Cornette will also manage a new tag team that will get a huge push and probably start after WrestleMania, and perhaps also manage Tiger Ali Singh. The basic idea is for Cornette to manage the younger prospect types and do interviews to get them over and help them in putting together their matches. So thankfully we never saw the Tiger Ali-Jim Cornette alliance.
It's funny, I'd completely forgotten. I thought at this point that they'd given up on Tiger Ali Singh after that, after that glorious match against Leaf Cassidy at One Night Only.
They'd recently just done another vignette for him, hadn't they, where it showed him, well, it's basically he's an Indian Del Rio.
Yeah. It showed him trundling across a little footbridge, yeah.
And they don't really do much with him. I mean, he does come back, but it's later in the year, isn't it? It's quite a while until they bring back Tiger Ali.
What was the tag team?
We'll get to that.
I thought it was someone irrelevant.
Lots of talk about giving Owen Hart the Intercontinental title belt along with the European title belt within the next month. So I guess there's a big plan for Owen here after Sean had pretty much done the one-off with him and then not worked with him again. So
Eurocontinental.
Eurocontinental was the plan for Rowan, although obviously it didn't come to pass. The one-man gang is going to get a tryout at the next WWF TV tapings.
Oh, fuck off.
The gang, now 37, is said to have trimmed down to 340 pounds.
Wow, he's felt.
Apparently this tryout did not go too well, and obviously they didn't hire him, but there's some odd tryouts that take place over the course of this couple of months.
Again, back to Vince and that comfort zone.
January 31st, there's a Boston house show for WCW that draws 18,759 fans for a card headlined... Jesus. By Hogan and Sting in a cage match. The show was supposed to be the debut of an internet pay-per-listen concept for $7.95, but they had technical problems to where the audio wasn't even available until the main event, so everyone's money was refunded.
Great forward planning and management by WCW. Yeah. But if I'm not mistaken...
It's their hallmark, really, isn't it?
I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but Jesus Christ. 18,000 for a house show in Boston. You put your pay-per-view in an arena that held 6,000 maximum. But I will say, on the subject of the technical difficulties, if I'm not mistaken, the internet feeds were done by Lee Marshall and Mark Madden at this point.
Oh.
So I guess those fans should have been thankful for small mercies.
Lee Marshall, who stinks on Thunderbolt.
I heard something else, what was that bit again with the internet thing then? So what was
pay per listen? It's basically radio. You'd pay in for the commentary of the match and the crowd audio.
You create a pay per radio essence kind of thing, right? And you fuck up on the audio. You have one fucking job to do to get this thing over.
We didn't bring any microphones.
Everyone plugged in the mics. You fucking balance. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You dickheads.
It's not like there's not going to be pay-per-view issues later in the year, you know? Shifting gears. On the topic of Shawn Michaels, he wouldn't be in line to do a job on pay-per-view without an injury cropping up now, would he? After taking a dangerous backdrop over the top rope with his lower back cracking the casket at the Rumble, Michaels missed shows the weekend of the Super Bowl, complaining that as the week went on, his back had stiffened up. This past week, Michaels' doctor sent word to the WWF that he had a variety of ailments, including a bruised kidney, a slightly separated shoulder, both hips out of alignment, a sprained foot, vertebrae in his back out of alignment, not to mention a worsening of his chronic knee problems.
It would have been fine if they hadn't put him in that bloody harness, like I said earlier.
I'm surprised he didn't add like deviated septum as well or something like that. Maybe blame that on the back injury.
Not buying it, Kieran?
I'm not buying it. You owe me 4 years, Sean.
Ahmed Johnson was hospitalised the morning of February 2nd when he collapsed on the airplane in Indianapolis due to dehydration.
Were they able to remove the trunks from the arse crack?
Oh, God.
So I guess all that weight wasn't water retention. Ahmed, by the way, looks terrible during this 2 month period.
You
can see the ball is starting to roll towards that big T phase of his career.
We move to the February 2nd episode of Raw. The show starts with, as you mentioned before, Carl, the Uncle Sam-ification of DX. They come out with the balloons falling from the building. They want this Tyson versus Austin match, and they're doing the chant, let them fight, let them fight.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, this is all... Obviously, we know it's Sean's trying to get out of the match with Austin at Mania, but the whole push is really on Austin and Tyson.
Oh, totally.
Surprisingly so. It's like, did Sean even realise? Because I'm surprised he's going along with it at this point. Yeah, very much. Obviously, it's you know, that's the start of the angle. So they're teasing Austin Tyson to fight, which is kind of a weird one in some respects, because then it's like you're setting up for a bit of a disappointment. But luckily, with the idea they had, that it didn't. So.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's an interesting point raised there about whether or not Michaels would have. It really dawned on him at the time, because you say he's such an egomaniac and such a volatile person, let's say, that you could picture the shit fit, couldn't you? I'm the champion, why am I third wheel in this? And it's remarkable now that the shit didn't really hit the fan, at least not in any discernible way.
Do you think there's any connection of him realising he's that third wheel, any connection to the sudden back problems that he's been having?
Totally, sir. He was pulling.
Seeing he was fine after Rumble, and then like, oh, third wheel.
Yeah, he started to pull a show, and he was like even putting the Mania match in today eventually. And I fully believe the reason he stayed away for so long. He saw he was on the outs. Austin, there's no way he was going to be getting his belt back off Austin anytime soon, take a bit of time out, and then he just spiraled out of control for him. Did he have? He probably wasn't, because the way he wrestled.
I mean, he did have the back surgery. I'm not down there's an injury at all here.
Yeah, but it's like the knee injuries. It's like they weren't career threatening. Yeah. They were minor compared to what was let on. So
So as the show goes on, the Tyson thing is toned down because they do the big dumpster angle with Chainsaw Charlie and Cactus Jack, where the New Age Outlaws push them off the stage. What does everybody think about this angle and the way it's done? Obviously, you've got the whole malarkey following it and a lot of insider talk.
There is a lot of insider talk, but on the whole, I actually really liked that angle as a standalone. And I'll say standalone for a particular reason, which I'll come to in a minute. I did like it. It was sort of nonsensical that you had the pair of them fighting each other, but, you know, JR dressed that up as well as JR can on commentary about, you know, throwing the old Middle Asian crazy and cats are not quite all there.
They showed the little sit down in the ring.
Prior to it. So they do sort of tee it up. Yeah. I thought it gives added weight to the New Age Outlaws. You know, they're building their momentum, so I thought it worked in that sense. You know, tearing down the dressing room wall worked, and you kept in, you know, you kept Austin away from it, you kept DX away from it until a skit later in the
until
back.
The gravy train off the heat.
Which, yeah, admittedly they do, but just in terms of who's out there at the time, I'm absolutely fine with who they had involved because it wasn't really pissing away other storylines, and it's sort of that chaotic nature where it starts to break down a bit and people trying to attack the Outlaws because
what they've done.
Is really good. And I will say, because God knows it, I'm sure it's someone I've probably given a lot of stick to and she'll get a lot more jibes as we go on, but I thought Sunny was absolutely fantastic here.
Crying her eyes out,
holding Terry's hand, I thought was really good. And it almost, to me, harkened back a little bit to AA and the ambulance with Woman screaming.
Yeah, good parallel.
And whilst I enjoyed all that, I was really disappointed that they came back at the end of the show.
Yeah, I agree with you on that last bit, but just like taking the angle at itself, and nobody can sell being borderline dead like Terry Funk, to be honest.
He is borderline dead.
He is the living dead, isn't he? Yeah, this is actually one thing we actually haven't commented on. Obviously, we're talking about Austin a lot, about Austin and Shawn Michaels and Undertaker Kane feud picking up steam as well around this point. Rock is coming across really well in the mid card. I think also at a slightly lower extent to the Austins and Rocks, the Outlaws are growing a lot, I think, during this time period where a pairing which seemed like pretty random at its genesis, there's now something formulating here. You know, they're getting their names, they're changing their gear. Billy Gunn's kind of clicking in terms of like what he needs to act like as a person. Road Dogg could talk anyway, we know that. And so he's clicking in terms of like what the dynamic is with Billy, which is I talk, you don't.
Yeah, but they hadn't quite figured that out yet because Billy was still doing the odd ring entrance, which was fucking atrocious.
He's going to give a dog a bone. Something like as vicious as this, I thought, really kind of elevated the Outlaws to a point where you can believe that a match with these two hardcore, you know, legends, if you want to use that term loosely or not, would actually be believable. It's just unfortunate that you can kind of see the I don't know what they call it, the packing foam or whatever.
The peanuts,
the packing peanuts there is just flying all over the place. when Cactus does the elbow and they fly up in the air, and when it tips over, it's just unfortunate. Safety's paramount, but there must have been like some other way where, you know, you didn't have bits of like kayfabe just flying off, basically. I don't know, just for that moment. I don't know, maybe there's another way they could have padded it.
Plenty of people have said what you've said. I don't think that you're out of line by saying that by any means. Yeah, not bad. Well, I wasn't too thrilled of them using the terms like, oh, are you that desperate to get over? Mm. And JR trying to explain what the word over is during this, but. Yeah. Again, little thing, I suppose. Big picture, this was good.
It was. It's one of those sort of negative hallmarks to me of the attitude here, though, that, you know, to blow through the ramifications of that angle so quickly and have them just back at the end of the show. It's
even then, don't you think? Because the reason Owen joined is because they did like the gang attack on Owen like halfway through the show. And they teased throwing him off the ramp as well. And I didn't like that because it just, especially because when they didn't do it and the crowd started to boo that they didn't, I thought that was a really bad way to go because it was just like, don't do it again. You've just done it. That can speak for itself. And then just, there was something about putting them in a position where it exposed that the crowd was into the stunt and not the guys that really kind of took a little bit of the sheen off this, to be honest with me.
Yeah, just, you know, with Owen, you think, you know, do a beat down in the back or something like that. Don't go right back to that sort of similar spot, if you like.
The main event of the show was Steve Austin versus the Roadie. This is one of the many other ways of getting Steve Austin in a match without actually doing any work. But this is where we get the great moment I want to talk about, where Austin gets tied up in the ropes and Sean has the belt right up to his face, screaming that this is as close as you're ever going to get. And the look on Austin's face is magic.
Oh, God, yeah, like... you'd think it's like just, you know, it's an easy angle to set up, but he does it in such a unique, pissed off, angry motherfucker. When I get out of these ropes, I'm gonna fucking kill you, son.
It's the eyes.
It is all the eyes.
That's it. You absolutely got it right. It's all in the eyes, because just down a fucking piss hole for Sean. He's just thinking, no, you're fucking jobbing to me.
It's rage. It's just pure rage on the show.
It's like he's no selling it, but he's not no selling it. He's just selling it in a way that no one else would.
And also, to give credit, I didn't mention it before, but when they did the Uncle Sam thing earlier in the show, and Austin comes out and they do their little back and forth, Sean's face too, just that dead eye stare of just, you know, just disdain for Austin. It's great both ways. The facial expressions from both guys on the show were just tremendous, and it really just sets up the great dynamic of the next 2 months, really, of Austin and Michaels. Is a really good angle. It's a really good feud, and they look like they hate each other. It's great.
Covert babyfaceness about DX, kind of maybe globbing on the new attitude. When he's in there with Austin, he ain't gonna be a pseudo babyface. No. Not to like 50%, not to 10%. It's 100% Steve Austin. Not trying to be something he's not. Not trying to get his own shits and giggles. He's working with someone who's on fire, and he needs to be on fire in his own role, in his own right, to not get overshadowed, because he's not. He realised he can't overshadow Steve Austin.
Yeah.
So you've got to be working up to his level. So.
Yeah, it's the one rare occasion where they don't do so much the no selling, or the old hands out, I'm so scared,
no,
sort of thing.
No.
It's the one point where Michaels is straight laced about it, because as you say, if he doesn't step up to the plate, he is just going to get steamrolled by something. What was the word I sent to you the other day? Austin at this point to me was like a juggernaut. And he was just going to steamroll everything in his path.
Which, and again, it's own right. This is another a sort of thing that made Steve Austin stand out. It was, you know, it was partly because he was so over and so great in his own right, but the fact that Sean's not doing the no-selling stuff.
Yeah.
But it also means it makes Austin even more of a serious challenge. It's just little elements that, by happenstance or conscious cognitive thought, it's just a magic dynamic.
It is great.
A bit of a precursor to what's actually going to work with Austin, which is going to be which is what they do in 1999, which is the numbers game. It's the insurmountable odds.
Oh, yeah, are you going to get heat on him?
Yeah, well, yeah, they've done it before to some extent, but usually it's like maybe it's just one, it's one on one in this.
One wants to heal was the method that Vince would go with before.
Now he's trying to look for again, evidently.
But now it's the group where it's like, you know, it's one person in charge of the group and the others are going to protect that person.
It's booking to the Austin character, because a one-on-one getting beat down by a big guy doesn't fit the Steve Austin character for me. But being outnumbered, still not giving a shit and going to try and kick the crap out of everyone, that's more in keeping with the character. So
over on Nitro, the same night, 21,213 fans in the Alamo Dome, carried mainly by the continuing Savage and NWO soap opera. It's scary when Hogan's interview is the best part of the show, says Meltzer.
Oh God!
Billy Kidman, Conan, and Scott Steiner all did power bombs while they're trying to do the angle that it's banned, and Nash keeps getting arrested for doing the power bomb. The main event of this show is Sting versus Randy Savage with a DQ. Sting comes down from the ceiling of the Alamo Dome, which is about 40 stories high. This is a very memorable entrance. It's got a huge pop, and the match had great heat, even though they really didn't do too much. Hogan pulls Savage off Sting after he hits the top of the elbow and has Sting beat, laid dead to rights, and Hogan pulls him off because he wants to be the guy to beat Sting, which the devaluation of Sting since Starrcade is shocking.
Savage and Sting again, and Sting's coming down from the rafters, and it's the Alamo Dome. I'm not going to say it's not an impressive feat in itself, but we've seen him come down from the rafters. It's not something new. We've seen throughout these shows, and we can hark back to 96. In 96, Steve Austin was the ringmaster. He's now Stone Cold Steve Austin. G's mentioned there, we had Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, who were the real Double J and Rockabilly. They've evolved. Shawn Michaels is no longer just the heartbreak kid pretty boy with aging scrotum sack Jose Lothario next to him. You know, he's a degenerate now. Triple H, we're not a big fan of him at this point, but he's at least evolving from the Aristocrat.
Up,
absolutely. We're seeing that progression. Rock, He's no longer Rocky Maivia. You know, he's no longer the blue chipper. He's the breakout star from this nation group. You know, Kane's debuted. Undertaker has been more humanized, if you like. Over on WCW, Hogan's turned heel. He's the champ. He's the leader of the NWO. Hall and Nash are there. NWO. Oh, and they've still got the tag belts by the time we get to 98, just to mention that. There are guys that are still being underutilized. See Chris Benoit. Nothing is, you know, they found a good formula, but in 18 months, you know, we'll go from the Hogan heel turn, if you like, and that's an 18-month span up to now. Nothing has evolved. There's no progression, except for Goldberg, who's not quite there yet, but he's improving, you know. The reactions are gaining traction. There's no advancement there for me, and the contrast just couldn't be starker.
Probably in terms of things that are being repeated so often that insults me the most, even more so than what you were mentioning, Carl, it's the fucking DQ finish again in the main event. I'm getting fucking sick and tired of this. And the run-ins, yeah. And more so than the Sting, you know, coming down to the ring or whatever. You know, we were mentioning about Vince, like, looking back at things that, like, work. At least for Vince, he was looking at stuff from a previous era. Bischoff's just looking at last week. And he's just fucking repeating, we're stuck in Groundhog's Day. Phil, is that you?
Just to mention the Sting thing as well. Okay, so he gets fucked when he wins the title. Then they take the belt off him in a fucky way anyway. Then he's not even in the main events when he is on shows. He's just...
He's a backdrop for another story now, which is the problem. It's no longer the Sting story in the big picture. However, despite everything that we've just said, Nitro does another record 4.9 this week. Goes up. Raw drops to a 3.45. Obviously not a major drop, but a drop nonetheless. Again, from their perspective, you can just see what they're thinking. This is the direction to go. Hogan and Savage, the numbers are going up. Meltzer says, I'm still trying to figure out why Ric Flair is at all the tapings. They have 3 hours with almost nothing good to fill it with, and why he's never on television after coming off his best match in years and doing the best interviews in the entire business. Bret Hart also hasn't been on since the Nitro after sold out, and Flair hasn't been on since sold out at all.
Well, they're pissed off for you know, going too long and you know, drawing that crowd.
Well, there you go. It was reported as a rumour in the February 3rd New York Daily News that Mike Tyson was mad that Don King told him he had to get a cut of what the WWF offered Tyson, and as a result is about to split from Don King. How this would affect WrestleMania is unknown, although it would enable the WWF to have a stronger storyline reason for not having the Tyson-Austin match after the Nevada State Athletic Commission didn't provide them with their convenient out. This is the bust-up of Tyson and Don King.
Really?
Funnily enough, the straw that broke the camel's back was that Don King wanted a licensing bonus for a possible Tyson action figure. Tyson found out and was fucking furious.
Don King, he's no Lucius Sweet.
Saying something where Tyson's the one with the kind of morals, or the good morals.
Let's not go that far.
Of the two.
The WCW Slamboree pay-per-view will be May 17th from Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. One would think that would be Hulk Hogan versus Bret Hart.
Doubt it.
More on that shortly. February 5th, Mike Tyson's role is officially announced as the outside-the-ring enforcer for Austin vs. Michaels at WrestleMania at a press conference at the official All-Star Cafe, which was attended by some 27 television cameras and more than 100 reporters from all over the world. The timing was fortuitous for the WWF, stemming from the mainstream media reports of the apparent Tyson-King business split that we've just talked about. Overall, King was taking so much of Tyson's money and left him near broke with a $7 million income tax bill to pay, and this was Tyson's first public appearance since that news broke, so there's a lot of media there based on that story.
Tyson to Austin, you're so uncouth. Stop hating people, start loving people.
Yeah, I know. It built to Michaels and Austin looking as if they wanted to go at it, with Tyson and Shane McMahon holding them apart. As the closing scene took place, Vince McMahon screamed, "Turn around, Mike," so that he could look and face the cameras.
Yeah, yeah. I always think of that scene. I don't hear that from Vince, but I always see that when you see that footage, but he's got his back to camera and he just suddenly,
turns around.
Yeah.
Vince, to counter, WCW opened negotiations in a virtually unpublicized effort that didn't come to fruition, attempting to get Evander Holyfield to referee the Hogan Sting Super Brawl match. Of course, nothing comes of it, but again, now that they've caught wind that this Tyson thing is going to happen, it's probably going to work. They're trying to get De La Hoya, they're trying to get Tyson back, they're trying to get Holyfield. Too little, too late on that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, they've got no damn direction themselves.
Is it to get a direction themselves, or is it to water down the impact of Tyson on WWF?
Probably a little bit, because then they can split the attention that it's wrestling using boxing, not the WWF. February 9th on Nitro, Hogan challenges Savage for a match on that show. Louis Spicoli does color commentary. I don't know where Larry is, but he was very good. Got a lot of attention for a very good role as a color commentator on this show. One of the big stories on this show is Goldberg pinning Steven Regal with a jackhammer in 5 minutes. Simply put, it doesn't matter the opponent, says Meltzer. Goldberg's matches have to be 90 seconds. He was totally exposed here, and everyone in the crowd saw it before their very eyes. This is the match that gets a lot of attention as Regal like going into business for himself, but it's not that at all.
No, this is the one. Regal gets a lot of heat for this to this day, and my understanding is he's basically...
It looks fucking odd. It's a bad match.
I won't try and defend it in that sense at all, but Regal was literally following instructions.
Yeah. Well, they look like they're trying to call it in the ring, and Goldberg's just way too green for that. And with the nature of his gimmick, Regal's trying to wrestle with him and stuff. In a way, it kind of achieves its goal that, you know, Goldberg lasted with a wrestler and smashed him anyway. But, yeah, this took on a bit of a life of its own afterwards. Really good match here. This show's in El Paso. So it's Jericho and Eddie Guerrero as a team against Dean Malenko and Chavo. And my God, is Eddie Guerrero over huge. He's a heel, but they're chanting, Eddie, it's thunderous. It doesn't matter what he does as a heel. They love him, and this is a really good match. The main event is Savage beating Hogan by disqualification after hitting the flying elbow, having the match won, and there's a running DQ, of course, and a beatdown. That's actually not the main event, so I take that back. The main event is Steiners beating Hall and Nash for the tag team titles, where Rick gets the pin with the Bulldog, and after the match, the teased ascension of the Steiners is kind of blown off as Scott hugs Rick, who's holding the tag belt. So it looks like this whole arc of the Steiners not getting along is in the past now, as the tag team champions.
Breathe easy, folks.
Over on Raw that same night, the start of the show is Steve Austin stealing the WWF Championship belt, which I didn't like this.
He doesn't steal it. He's teleportation techniques of Steve Austin or something. He just has it.
He just owns the belt.
Sean doesn't realise he's been carrying around a foam belt in his bag. Yeah. It's like...
Yeah.
There's slight discrepancy there.
Well, I suppose if you're that pilled up, it's, you know, you lose...
you just think it's superhuman strength.
Yeah.
They start the Sable Luna tension on this show as well, which obviously pays off near WrestleMania. It's a bit of a slow burn here. The Jackal descends from the ceiling on a pulpit during a Recon versus Steve Blackman match. The match stunk, to be quite honest.
Oh, God, it's atrocious. But, like, the promo is so monotonous. It goes on and on. He's coming
down.
It's
one long rant.
The camera is flicking between the quote unquote action in the ring. the attention's so split, but the promo's so shit, and it's just like this doubly mind-numbing effect where you've kind of time stands still for like approximately 10 hours, but it's only like 30 seconds. And then after these great long promo, his guy loses.
Yeah, I know, it's awesome.
And he slaps him across the face.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, after this segment, if your eyes weren't bleeding from what was going on in the ring, your ears probably were from what you were hearing.
Not surprisingly, the rating bombed for this segment, unfortunately. Mm. The show ends with DX coming out for an interview, and Steve Austin follows, and Austin is red hot over here. The Outlaws come out as well. At this point, Chainsaw Charlie cuts a hole in the ring, and he and Cactus come from underneath. Owen Hart also just kind of shows up. While all this was going on, China managed to steal back the WWF title belt, and obviously they're teasing it's a big 4-on-4, it's happening at the pay-per-view. Nice and simple, but Austin is over like God here. It's like Austin's in the ring trying to like ward off all five of them, and the crowd's just chanting for him. The ratings, the numbers. Nitro with a 4.6 towards 3.2. Both numbers taking a little bit of a dip this week.
Just out of curiosity there, Liam, just before you move on, is that the third week in a row that the Raw numbers dropped?
It is indeed. It's dropping little bit by little bit, but yeah, back to a 3.2. Pretty low for the stands after it's the Tyson angle.
Post-football as well.
Post-football, yeah.
WrestleMania season, I suppose, different times, but yeah, still.
So I suppose in retrospect, you have to give them credit for the fact that they sort of, in this sense, we talked about how in earlier podcasts when looking at summer, Vince is sort of flailing around and throwing shit at the wall. So you've got to give him credit for not panicking here and staying with the plan. And
a couple of things. First of all, they didn't have anything else.
Well, no.
which is why Austin and Co. were getting a chance. But I would still assume that Austin's individual quarters were doing massive numbers.
Yeah, they do very well.
So that indicator is, you know, this must mean they're building up to we're gonna enter the Austin era. We're not in the Austin era really yet. So this is the kind of the period where the growth period.
The one time I put a positive outlook on things, and you shoot me down.
At one point, the plan was to shoot an angle at this week's Nitro, which apparently was to lead to Flair and Bret Hart as a tag team against Hall and Nash. But Flair was booked to be at the Toy Fair representing WCW, so one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. Flair has basically agreed to a 3-year deal with WCW, but hasn't actually signed the piece of paper. Rumours that he might be leaving naturally started since he's disappeared from television for weeks, but that's premature. So, in addition to Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair is also working without a contract during this war period.
So he wasn't there because he was at a Toy Fair?
Yeah, what? Yeah,
was he supposed to be working there, or was he just fancy going toy shopping? what was he there for?
Maybe he was checking like the receipts of the action figures to see if he was getting his royalties.
Maybe he was. God damn it. In timing that is being considered by many as easily predictable, WWF champion Shawn Michaels was diagnosed on February 11th as having two herniated discs in his lower back, supposedly aggravated by weight training the previous day. Michaels was treated with cortisone shots to alleviate the problem and was told to stay bedridden for at least 1 week after being kept at San Antonio Methodist Hospital overnight for treatment and was released the next day. The injuries don't even allow Michaels to travel to the pay-per-view in nearby Houston. The WWF released the news that Michaels would most likely not be appearing on the pay-per-view immediately on its hotline.
It's amazing what a bit of nightmares can do. So that explains why, after Rumble, for the first couple of Raws, he was fine, right? Because he didn't know his back was bad. He was all right. Did some weightlifting, aggravated it, and now he's got issues. Mm. That's the story. Catch up.
And the harness didn't help. Don't sleep on the harness.
The planned WCW Slamboree pay-per-view in Toronto that we talked about before, with the idea being Hogan and Bret, has been moved to Worcester, Massachusetts. There were several reasons for the move, the main one being they wanted to go with Hogan versus Hart for the title, but Bischoff felt he wanted to save it for later in the year and build it up long and slow, learning the lesson of the Hogan-Sting buy rate. What a build this has been. We're still waiting for this match. A bit of unfortunate news here, though. Well, very unfortunate news. February 15th, Louis Spicoli is found dead. Ew. 6 days after doing the commentary spot on Nitro. Spicoli had taken 26 somas, a prescription sleeping pill / painkiller that is the drug of choice in the wrestling profession today, and choked to death on his own vomit. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to Spicoli here. His on-screen role as the lackey of Scott Hall was actually based on real life, where he was pretty much hanging around Scott Hall all the time, which probably didn't help. But he was known to have these problems for a long time, and unfortunately this was it. Mixing it with wine apparently was the thing that made him throw up.
And regrettably, unfortunately, it's another new name to add to the casualty list, and one of those things that really, really grates on me, and I know it's something that's mentioned in the Death of WCW book that Alvarez did, in the sense that something as drastic as this, and there's not really much time to pause and reflect on it in a what you call an appropriate way. You know how in more recent times you'd have tribute shows and that sort of thing, and a proper sort of time to reflect on someone dying at such a young age whilst being in the business. Whereas obviously with Pillman, yes, you get the distasteful Melanie Pillman bit, and you get the 10-bell salute, but the show goes on really as if nothing's happened. There's no pause or anything. And with Spicoli, he's not as big a star as Pillman was, don't get me wrong, but the fact that they couldn't even find it in themselves to really break away from the storyline of the time and have Zbyszko's remarks on TV.
Yeah, we'll get to them. They weren't good. We can't dwell on that. We got a show to do.
We're in the midst of a war.
Yeah, we've got numbers to get.
Yeah, if we pause and stop, WWF's got Tyson, and what the hell's going to happen?
That same day, February 15th, is WWF's No Way Out of Texas pay-per-view. 16,110 fans sell out the building, a 0.52 buy rate for 147,500 buys, so obviously a dip from the Rumble. Savio Vega.
Right.
Buddy Quan.
I'm catching up on 98. I buy Royal Rumble tape. I love it. Buy WrestleMania 14 tape, love it even more. Figure out that No Way Out in Texas is the in-between show. Okay, looking thing positive. Look at the main event. This looks fucking awesome. Austin, Red Hot, Owen, who turned up on the bus, right, Cactus Jack, Chainsaw Charlie, versus Shawn Michaels, Triple H and New Age Outlaws. I couldn't believe it. I thought, wow, how is that? So actually, Shawn Michaels did team up with the New Age Outlaws before, like, he scarpered. This is fantastic. We're going to see, like, probably a better connotation of DX than there ever was. This is fantastic. I cannot fucking wait for this. Savio fucking Vega. Are you fucking kidding me, right? I want you to find that he's not on the card, and I'm waiting for it, going like, well, who the fuck are they going to have? I'm not going to bring in Undertaker or Kane. I go, what's it going to be? Sario fucking Vega? Oh, Jesus Christ. Of everybody.
It's the way they announce it, which is great. Like, and the groan in the crowd.
Yeah, and it's, oh my, it wasn't, that wasn't the groan from the crowd. That was my groan that you could hear from a distance. That's how fucking bad it was. Sario fucking Vega. Jesus Christ, a fucking loaf of bread would have been better than that, you such piece of shit.
And they don't even have Sabio do the job. Road Dog does the job.
It's like, it's the most pointless thing. Anybody would have been better than fucking Savio Vega, the Lost Barica.
They thought they were being clever because they'd done the thing where Shawn had paid off the Baricas to attack Owen previously.
Yeah, they'd been involved with them for a few weeks doing their dirty work and stuff, and China rallying the troops to go and
find Austin. Spanish.
Yeah. So, which is a lot easier to stomach than listening to her speak English, by the way. Yeah, so what was I saying before about lack of stars?
Yeah, I was sort of thinking about this during one of our little breaks, and I was actually thinking this exact moment, right? Thinking like, who fucking would have been better? Like literally anyone would have been better than Savio Vega. I would even argue put most likely Riccardo on this. I'd probably even argue that China would have been a fucking better option, because at least she was part of DX. They could have kept her out of harm's way. You know what I mean? She's just there. On the ring apron,
and she took a stunner at the end of the show. Anyway,
exactly. That's the only bit where I've seen.
And
your
the
notes.
Crowd popped for that, by
oh,
the
yeah,
way.
Ballistic.
Yeah, that's the part when I've seen your notes when you say it was a fun main event. And outside of Savio Vega, yeah, particularly the finish, the whole sequence of the finish.
As soon as Austin gets the tag,
he absolutely rallies everyone, hits a stunner on Road Dogg. 1, 2, 3. Music plays. Instantly gets up. Ducks underneath Billy Gunn, who's trying to do a post-match attack, stunners him, and then just as he's like, yeah, fuck you, just turns around, sees Triple H on the apron, just runs over, knocks him off, so Triple H just careers into the bloody announce table, and just walks around like a fucking badass, and you're just there going, yep, that's the guy. And then, like, obviously China gets in his face, and for the first time for me, I'm like, hit the woman.
It was very jarring when it actually happens. It's jarring to see her give him the finger, and like, he just gives that great look to the crowd, like, oh, really? Okay, then fuck you.
Fucking bitch. Oh, and the crowd are just lapping it up. You get Austin just going and grabbing the mic for no reason afterwards and just shouting, oh, hell yeah, which the crowd eat up even more. And JR is brilliant on the call during all this. And just obviously the one remark you have as Austin's walking back down the line, you've got JR just sort of screaming in the way that only JR can. Steve Austin is roaring into WrestleMania.
And whilst back in Shawn Michaels' house, another disc has been herniated.
Other than what was a fun main event with a lot of shortcuts and obviously the crowd going nuts, this show is shit.
Drizzling fucking
to,
shit.
To the point of Kieran's lack of depth remarks.
Who's left?
There is. We've got Taka Michinoku against Pantera. The Headbangers against Mero and Goldust.
Marilyn Dust.
Which is basically just a setup for the Sable Bomb, which admittedly, you know, does go over huge, but still. And let's not forget the other tag classic that is the Godwins versus the Quebecers.
As Dave Meltzer says, this is actually going to wind up being the most famous match on the card, because they're going to end up having a Supreme Court fight in California over whether or not forcing criminals to watch tapes of Godwin's Quebecers over and over constitutes cruel and unusual punishment.
There are two things.
Another singer from Dave.
two things on the show, because I've actually tried to, and quite successfully, forget this show. Okay, what was the Rocks match in this?
It's the War of Attrition. It's the Nation against the illustrious combination of Shamrock, Ahmed, and all three members of DOA. Although, having said that, again, Meltzer gives him a rave review. Maya Villa showed a near superstar level performance, and Shamrock's work is improving as well. Shamrock taps The Rock out here, and The Rock slaps Farouk to progress their angle. Farouk responds by punching D'Lo Brown. Because D'Lo just has to eat it, apparently.
Yeah, he does.
Kane defeats and injures Vader in storyline as well. We move to the next night there. February 16th is an unopposed Nitro, because Raw's gone to the dogs. So the company, WCW, puts up a graphic to start the show mentioning that Lou Spicoli's died, including a three-bell salute. And as you mentioned, Carl, Larry Zbysko blows it off in a rather tasteless fashion.
Yeah, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but it's this sense of Zbysko, completely in character, doesn't break away from the storyline because they'd sort of been having this mini-feud on TV, and just generally says that he won't speak ill of the dead.
Schiavone asks Zbysko for his thoughts about the passing of Louis Spicoli. And Zbysko just says, well, I would give my thoughts, but out of respect for the family, I won't. Pretty much indicating that he was going to bury him because he wants to keep his, you know.
Yeah, it's disappointing from Larry. What would you put that down to on Larry's point? Him being a prick or just a misjudgment?
There was a bit of a
him trying to be the worker all the time.
Yeah, well, he's from the old school, so it's probably a bit of that mentality. And also, nobody was allowed to mention it beyond that. There was actually a bit of a directive from WCW, don't mention the Spicoli death. There were guys who wanted to mention him and were told not to. Jericho wearing a black armband is about the only other reference to this, if I remember right. So, speaking of the depth on the WCW side, Mike Enos beats Barry Horowitz on this show. They did one of the lamest angles on record on this show as well, as Tony Schiavone started screaming that there was trouble in the back, and when we got there, Davey Boy Smith was walking around sipping coffee. Then, Steve McMichael showed up and they did the pull-apart brawl.
Oh my god.
So I guess that's what they thought.
Look, it's like the BBC saying that Tower 7 had fallen like 15 minutes before he actually had. Sometimes, good question.
Similar catastrophes, one could argue. Rick Martel wins the TV title off Booker T after the Flock interferes. Bret Hart cuts a promo on Hulk Hogan, challenging him to a match, when Bryan Adams shows up and says that he will watch his back, and then he turns on him and joins the NWO. Flair makes his return and makes the save, and Bret and Flair shake hands. So this is the return of Flair after weeks away, and Bryan Adams straight in the New World Order. Crush, what a pickup!
And if the NWO couldn't be diluted any further, they've picked up a jailbird.
Yeah. Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko beat Chris Jericho and Eddie Guerrero, that team again, another really good match. So it's a shame they didn't really continue with this team of Jericho and Guerrero because they got great chemistry together. Sting and Luger versus Hogan and Savage is the main event, and I will give anybody a drink if they can guess what the finish was.
Ooh, wait.
It'll come to me.
DQ?
With the NWO running in, and of course Bret Hart and Ric Flair also run in for the save. It's actually a pretty good ending, very spirited, where you got the four pillars of Sting, Luger, Bret and Flair as the faces of WCW against the NWO, and they're making a big deal of it with the NWO's dissension, WCW's finally rallying. The unopposed 3-hour Nitro set the all-time record with a 5.1, so they do finally hear break the barrier. To say the WCW behind the scenes is tumultuous would be an everyday thing, but the situation has become far more extreme than usual. It is impossible to have 100 wrestlers under contract and keep them all happy under any circumstances. Although there is basically little or no chance of Flair leaving, to the best of our knowledge he has still not signed his contract, although he is working under a new 3-year deal with a substantial raise. Hulk Hogan, who to the best of our knowledge is also not signed, is playing up his power for all it's worth. While Hogan has been the focal point of the promotion, he's now booking his TV angles to where there are a million angles on TV, but none of them mean anything, and the announcers really don't emphasize any of them except his program with his shadow Randy Savage, and starting the tease for the eventual program with Bret Hart. For all the reasons anyone can imagine, most of the mid-card talent is unhappy. Juventud Guerrero was reluctant to lose his mask, but agreed that after being told it would be built up as a big deal for months, perhaps in a mask versus hair match with Jericho, since Jericho's hair would create a lot of interest as well. He figured it would also give him time to work to a simultaneous program in Mexico where he'd lose his mask and it would be a huge news story there. Well, he figured wrong. He showed up at Nitro on February 9th and found out he was supposed to lose his mask at Super Brawl and felt double-crossed. His big promised push wound up being a loss to Kidman, a win over El Dandy, and an angle with Jericho, and that's all, folks. Things got even worse at this past week's Nitro. The Malenko Guerrero Benoit group feel that no matter how hard they work and how much crowd heat they get, there is no upward mobility. The resentment was amplified after being told for so long to be patient and wait their turn, then seeing Bryan Adams show up on his first day and immediately get into an angle with Bret Hart and the NWO. Bischoff told Malenko that he and the others were great workers, but they don't put asses in the seats, which, when word got around, made a lot of people hot because they actually have elsewhere and have never gotten the chance in WCW. Eddie Guerrero actually went to Eric Bischoff and tried to get a contract release, but was turned down, snapped at, and Bischoff accidentally spilled coffee all over him in his rampage, although Bischoff did later apologise.
Yeah, I'm glad that at least Eddie Guerrero tried to take the initiative there, because when you were just saying, like, the people involved who aren't happy, it's like, well, it fucking took him 2 years to try and get out of there, for fuck's sake. But the Hogans and so on are the draws of the company, but he knew that, like, the Eddie Guerreros and so on were vital to the show's overall value. Welcome to WCW, GV. I mean, fuck's sake. I mean, in terms of losing the mask, I actually preferred him without the mask.
I thought
he was much better. Of the wrestlers who did lose their masks, he was the one that should, along with Conan, because I can't remember if Conan debuted in a mask or not.
Nah, he was a little Vader mask, but it didn't last.
Nah, whatever, yeah.
The latest NWA angle, we mentioned Cornette's tag team, will be the revival of a new Midnight Express tag team. I believe it will be Bob Holly and Bart Gunn, although it might be... Oh. It might be Adam Copeland and Sean Morley, although the NWA angle is dying to the masses. It is, in fact,
dead.
Dying. It was never alive.
I was going to say,
stillborn.
Dying suggests that at some point this body was warm. In truth, it's always been a cold corpse.
Thoughts on the potential Edge Venus tag team?
Obviously not
with that gimmick, but yeah.
No, it would have been
not with that gimmick, but just like that as a team. That's a bit of a weird one.
Who cares? It didn't happen.
And no matter how good they were, it didn't matter. If they were part of the NWA angle, they would have got absolutely nowhere. Yeah. They got dropped. Raw takes place on February 21st. It's on a Saturday. Jim Cornette did an interview saying the NWA was better than the WWF and introduced Tommy Young as the official NWA referee. Mero was yelling at Sable for wearing a Steve Austin t-shirt. Anyway, someone came out and brought Sable flowers. Mero started yelling at her and she walked out on him with the flowers.
I just realised, are they teasing? It's Austin.
Yes. That was where this angle was going. It's in an Observer this week that the plan is for Austin and Sable to be put together as a modern-day Savage and Elizabeth but sleazier version.
Oh, God.
So that's what this was. The angle when they did that stare down that we mentioned at the start of this podcast, that was the beginning of it. They had Sable modelling the Austin t-shirts while Mero was gone.
Yep.
This was building the idea of Austin and Sable as a duo.
That would have been awful, but I can see why they're doing it. And not because of the whole they're trying to make a new Savage and Elizabeth. It's just like you got like the hottest guy and then the hottest girl.
Yeah,
combined with even hotter. Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. But also, like in terms of like pointing out other little things, you know, like that are developing well on the road to WrestleMania. Mark Mero and Sable.
Mero's underrated.
It's getting good. This is like pretty good. Mero's fight, like with the Outlaws. Mero's finding his stride a little bit now.
Some good heat.
Yeah, he's not doing the freaking confetti shit anymore. Or, you know, the wild man, whatever. He's now finding something that's going to work for him, being the douchebag mid card heel, which he does it really well, and he plays excellently. And Sable, the basic character that there is a great foil for that because she's just got to stand there and take it.
Yeah, certainly better than Savio and the Godwins, I suppose.
God, fuck's it. Fuck, Mero in the main event of fucking No Way Out would have been better than fucking Savio Vega.
It wouldn't have got much... It wouldn't have got much better reaction, to be quite honest.
Savio fucking Vega.
Not getting Shawn Michaels, getting the Marvelous one.
Yeah, but he would have come out with Sable, so that would have got a reaction.
Yeah, given that they were planning on Sable Austin, I'm surprised they didn't, actually.
Could have done a tease there.
Yeah.
Also on this show, while we're talking about heels who have momentum, perhaps a little bit more, Rocky Maivia
gave the other members
of the Nation of Domination presents. He gave Karma, D'Lo and Mark Henry Rolex watches.
$55,000 Rolex watches.
Yeah. Then gave Faruga wrapped a gift, which was a life-size poster of Rocky holding the Intercontinental title belt. Faruga got mad and threw the poster down, but Rocky ran after it.
This fucking angle
must
be
a rare art.
Rock has been fantastic up until this point, right? Yeah, we've seen him develop like leaps and bounds over this. This is one of the real first, this is exceptional now. Like this guy's really, really on fire now with this. And just like the Rolexes, the picture, Farouk's face. Let's not underplay fucking Ron Simmons on this. Well, the more I watch Ron Simmons around this time, the more I like him. Like he's good.
This is the best work of Farouk's career.
Farouk's fucking face. It looks like someone's just slapped shit in his hand. It's just fucking brilliant.
The fucking lackeys there, like modelling their little watches, looking at each other.
They're fucking comparing watches. It's the same watch. They're comparing watches. Farouk's on this fucking picture. The Rock holding the belt with his eyebrow raised, and just Rock's just like, yeah, you got the special treat. I just remember that fucking angle. I've locked it away in my memory, hoping that one day I'll be in the same situation and I can do that to some fucking asshole who I hate. Just a picture of me.
It's gonna be me, isn't it?
It is.
The main event of this show is Goldust and Mark Mero versus Cactus and Chainsaw. Raw does a 3.0 here, and opposed to obviously Saturday, so not a too bad number, 3.0 for a out-of-time slot show. That same day, Vince McMahon appears on Off the Record with Michael Landsberg to talk about the Montreal situation that had happened previously. Vince's explanation for why he did it is, a lot of reasons actually, Brett was breaking down physically. Brett was getting to be a little bit of a pain in the ass in terms of his attitude. He was disruptive in the locker room to a certain extent. He wanted things his way. To a certain extent, I can understand understand that, but we have to move on and we have to progress in what we do. We can't hold back. Brett's value began to wane, and I looked at it in terms of, I think I was really sorry after I'd done the deal. I was sorry that I had. Had everything gone smoothly, then we would have lived with it. It was then that I decided that, you know, maybe Brett would be better off financially somewhere else, and we thought we would be better off financially without Brett.
I'm surprised I didn't call him a fucking racist child molesting dog raper or something.
He did try and say that he's not a Canadian hero, he's only a Canadian hero in his own mind, and then Landsberg just says, no, Vince, I'm Canadian, Bret Hart is a Canadian hero, trust me.
Half of that you read out there, it's you almost kind of thinking like, hold on a second, did you hear the question mark? Because it sounds like he's talking about Sean then for a moment. He's talking like broken down or whatever, you know,
disruptive.
Or disruptive in the locker room, all that stuff. It's like, Vince, just your shit don't smell right.
The next day, February 22nd, it's WCW Super Brawl. 12,620 fans sell out the Cow Palace, a 1.1 buy rate for 320,000 buys. Under normal circumstances, that number would be considered huge, but it actually fell greatly under expectation since the first Hogan Sting did a 1.9, and internally, the company was predicting a 1.6 for this show, particularly after sold out, without either Hogan or Sting on the show, topped a 1.0 for Flair and Brett. Sting beats Hogan to become the WCW champion after Randy Savage interferes and sprays WCW on Hulk Hogan after the match is finished, which is probably what he should have done at Starrcade. Juventud Guerrero is, of course, unmasked on this show, and Scott Steiner turns heel on his brother Rick, costing them the tag titles, and he joins the New World Order.
Wait, but hold on a sec. Just the other week, they hugged after winning the belt, and so they weren't going to do the heel angle.
Well,
that's weird.
How valuable those belts are. He's willing to throw them away just to join the NWO.
Yeah.
Harking back to what we mentioned before, Sting, even now with the world title, is still remaining as that backdrop, because Savage Hogan's the story.
February 23rd, the day after this pay-per-view, Ahmed Johnson is fired from the WWF. This stems from an incident at the Raw tapings last week, where he was instructed to do a job for Kurgan using the claw, and he refused and walked out. The end result may have been more desired than what was being asked. As it was, Titan has legally gotten out of his contract, which had 4 more years remaining on a 5-year deal because he breached it by walking out. So they didn't have to pay him off, basically. So that is the end of Ahmed.
I could see that.
On the previous Raw, Ahmed lost to The Rock, but it was clear from watching that match with The Rock that he's just fodder now. He's just a guy.
Oh, yeah, but I still wouldn't want to lose to Kurgan.
What, even on your worst day?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to lose to Kurgan with the claw.
Well,
I'd rather stay in the buffet line, to be honest, if I was him.
Well, that's pretty much what ended up happening.
I was going to say, the fact that he walked out on 4 years' worth of guaranteed money? You'd assume he'd probably saved quite a bit from his previous contract, judging by how he reappeared a few years later. He didn't miss any meals.
There was no way he was thinking he was getting fired.
No, he thought he was too big a star for it, surely.
Well, and it's just the shit that's gone down in the business, both sides, the last couple of years. Everyone's foolproof because it's a worker's game, because talent's in demand. Mm. He overvalued his own value to them, I guess, and they fucking rubbing their hands of glee. Bye-bye.
February 23rd on Nitro. A great show. Opened up with DDP, Booker T, Ric Flair and Bret Hart talking about how disappointed they were with Scott Steiner's heel turn. It's really good because they put a tremendous amount of emphasis on Scott Steiner's turn and treat this as like one of the bigger betrayals and defections in the history of the NWO angle. It's really good stuff. Scott Steiner comes out with his new blonde hair.
Yeah.
So his look changes immediately. And again, the emphasis on this really, it just feels credible. And again, that evolution. We're seeing a character evolving finally here in WCW.
Yeah, it's a rarity. And I think not something you'll hear me utter very frequently, but I think Shivani's very good in this point as well, where he just sort of screams something along the lines of, "Will you just look at him?" Just as he whips the sunglasses off.
And, beats up Lex Luger.
You know, you want to give him credit for it, but at the same time, I look at it as another guy turning. And I even did then, in truth.
Yeah.
Even then, and I've watched it back, and it's very well done, but. Yeah,
white noise to you at the time,
A little bit. Pretty much. By this point, you've had so many defections, and some of them are no marks that you wouldn't care about anyway. But the whole
crush. You just had him a couple
and,
weeks
and,
ago.
And the whole concept has been diluted down to such a point now where you just sort of shrug.
Hogan versus Savage in a cage is made for Uncensored on this show. Raven and Benoit have a pretty hot brawl. Ric Flair saves Bret Hart again and does a great promo. It's actually a really good one where Flair's, again, that kind of babyface Flair humility that you like sometimes when he comes out and says, after Bret beat me after all that I talked about being the man and all that stuff. I was dreading the idea of turning on Nitro and seeing what Bret was going to say, but Bret Hart just said that even though to be the man you got to beat the man, Ric Flair, you'll always be the man. And Flair was like, the fact that you did that means you're in my good books for life. And it's like, it's just a really good promo. And it's, you love Flair in a role like this. Like, he should never turn heel again, for God's sake, WCW. Yeah. They spent the entire show building to Scott Hall getting his title match from World War III, when he won that match about 5 months ago, against Sting, which never happened because there's a big beatdown on Sting by the NWO. And Hulk Hogan spray paints HH on his chest. Throughout the show, they teased a new member of the New World Order, and out came a bearded Ed Leslie as the newest member.
Oh, for fuck's sake!
He's back!
Oh, God!
And it's not in pog form.
I think I'd have preferred Savio Vega.
They've taken a relevant member of the roster, tried to give some emphasis on the fact that he's joined the NWO, tried to play it up a bit, and it works up to an extent. And what do you come away from the show seeing?
That dick
the fucking booty man in an NWO shirt.
I guess Hogan's dick was cold.
It was either that or Ed Leslie's nose.
Yeah. Raw obviously is a taped show, but it airs live on the Monday head-to-head against Nitro again. Legion of Doom brawled with each other after a loss to the New Age Outlaws. So this is the LOD pretty much disappears after this until WrestleMania. Yeah. Jim Cornette accidentally hits Jeff Jarrett with a tennis racket. And they lost to Ken Shamrock, and the Headbangers beat the Rock and Roll Express for the NWA Tag Team title. So the NWA are really on a roll here, and this is pretty much the end of Jarrett and Cornette as a connection, if I'm not mistaken.
It is the end, yeah.
And by the way, what did happen to that Jarrett-Owen thing from the Rumble?
Russo must have booked it.
Yeah. Paul Bearer challenges Steve Austin for a match next week. Not against him, obviously, against Kane. Dusty Dust appears to take on Bradshaw. This is obviously Goldust is the artist mocking his dad. Jim Ross makes sure to get the line in that Dusty has a good laugh about all this. It's not in there, you know, mean spirited or anything like that. Yeah, you get the silhouette of Dustin talking like Dusty, and then the match. Really weird match, because at one point he gets out of the ring and gets on the mic and says, "You should be bumping around like this ring like crazy for me, and you better let me start beating you up." Stuff like that. Very odd. Bradshaw just clotheslines him and beats him.
Yeah, but was it midway through the flip flop and fly? Waylays him with a clothesline and it's over.
Yeah. Mero versus Owen Hart is the main event on this show, which is again primarily done just to set up the mixed tag at WrestleMania, where you have a big brawl between Sable and Luna again, but Mero decks Goldust here, and that's pretty much the last thing you see on this show. There's a promo at Shawn Michaels' house. That's pretty much all you see for the main event stuff on this show. Triple H gets a line in about how if you're looking for ratings, that's why you're here in San Antonio at Shawn's house.
That's when they're playing pool.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one. Nitro does a 4.6 this week to Raw's 3.25. So again, Raw's hovering around that 3.2, 3.25 area. A slow decline after the Tyson angle. Here's an odd note. Eric Watts was just this past week given his WWF release. He was still under contract from 1995 and hadn't been used in years.
Literally just realised.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute!
What the fuck's this guy doing under contract?
Any word on his Techno Team 2000 tag partner Chad?
No.
Okay.
No. John Tenta looked impressive enough in a dark match recently that he's expected to be
off. Yeah, because the lights were off.
Expected to be offered a deal, given a new gimmick, and pushed as a potential challenger for Steve Austin's title after WrestleMania.
Well, thank God that didn't happen.
Bloody hell.
But again, you got to think, they were looking for Gang, they were looking, again, here for Earthquake, who hadn't been doing anything.
Kurgan's getting a push,
Kurgan's
for some reason.
Push. Within the industry, nobody believes Shawn Michaels was injured as badly as he claims, although at this point, even if he was, nobody would believe it. There were stories that when he was supposed to have been bedridden the day of the pay-per-view, he was riding around all afternoon on a friend's motorbike. There was a decent shot he will do Mania no matter what, but then take time off after Mania to rest up. And that is the final note that we have for this two-month period from the Wrestling Observer newsletter. A very crazy two-month period. It's only going to get crazier here. I can't wait for the next episode of the Monday Night War timeline as we do March and April, because Jesus Christ, it gets crazy. And it's been crazy enough here. A very interesting 2 months. Lots of changes, lots of excitement. Everybody's final takeaways for January and February of 98.
I talked before about how I felt, you know, you had as clear a contrast as you could up to this point of the sort of the positive aspects of WWF with their character development, you know, lacking in roster depth, but you know, positive character development and elevation of guys, whereas it's sort of the epitome of the bad things that you associate with WCW, of a sort of static picture, mid-card unhappy because there's no progression. So, you know, we're not at the point where things are collapsing for WCW yet, but the good ship has started its voyage towards the iceberg.
We can already see the blueprint here of WWF are going to start succeeding bit by bit, and you know the sheen is starting to come off with WCW, even if the ratings don't reflect that just yet. They will. Sting wins the title, loses the title, disappears for a while, wins the title back, no one gives a shit. Bret Hart, Flair get paired together, babyface versus babyface. They have a match, disappear for weeks. The mid-card are unhappy. The undercard is unhappy. People want to get out of contracts. Savage and Hogan are just like just stinking up the place. We have a really good heel turn in Scott Steiner, which would have been great if it wasn't for the fact that you have fucking Bryan Adams joining the week or two before, and freaking booty shit cockmaster joining the week after, or on the same freaking show, whatever. So that makes that fucking irrelevant. Yeah, okay, the fall hasn't happened yet, but Jesus Christ, they're digging the grave already. You know, the shovel's been taken out. And whilst on the other side, yeah, we got freaking DOA and all this bullshit coming, but they know they got money with Tyson, and they know that from the ratings they did when Tyson did turn up. So they know by now, surely the buy rate will get affected by this. Even if with him not being on the shows, the ratings are low. They just, in terms of that angle, they just got to deal with Michaels, which is just kind of ironic considering when they felt that Michaels was a safe bet and they had to deal with Bret Hart at Survivor Series, and now like it's now the shoe's on the other foot. But yeah, you know, you got further development with The Rock, which has been successful. Ken Shamrock too, the New Age Outlaws, Mick Foley and Terry Funk are there as helping hand. Sable's getting over. Everything's kind of on the move, even if like you know not all the components are there yet. You know, we haven't got the top four yet.
As we said before about being a partisan WF fan, I think this is the period when that really hit home for me, because. Yeah, before then, thinking we used to watch WCW Saturday and stuff on ITV, and this, the frustration I had at the stagnation of WCW and the emergence of all this talent getting lit on fire in the WWF and their uses and elevation of it, and how just amazing Austin Rock were, particularly Austin, and the reactions he was getting, but it not being reflected in the overall ratings, that made me side with them because I fucking love this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is when it, yeah, just thinking about then, that's kind of his elevation and ascension. You know, I wanted it to be successful because he was fucking awesome and he deserved it. And, you know, I guess we'll talk about that on the next episode.
Everything changes in the next 2 months, and it's just amazing to see how quick it all changes when it comes to March and April. So very much looking forward to that in the near future. Next week, of course, we are doing, as we said at the start, part 2 of Wrestling's Scummiest Moments. We have all of your feedback that you left last week for us that we're going to get to. Lots of fantastic, devious, horrible things to talk about, and hopefully it'll be a very entertaining and insightful show. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be speaking to you again next week for G. John Chase.
Savio fucking Vega!
For Carl Jones!
I need my Horlicks.
And for Kieran O'Rourke.
I want those 4 years, Sean.
I am Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here. Talk to you next week!